communicate by show of hands so that you can be provided.
So we all have. Thank you then. Shall we then open this meeting by observing a moment of silence for prayer and meditation? Thank you. Good afternoon, honorable members. Good afternoon to all our important stakeholders, including South African Local Government Association, Equal Education, and the Rural Health Advocacy Project, and the South African Catholic Bishops Conference, the Department of National Treasury, who are all here. I'd also like to greet the staff members and all guests. You are all welcome. I wish to welcome you to this important public hearing. Public hearing, because there are so many submissions, okay, to be hearing, wherein we will receive submissions and inputs from our stakeholders on the 2017 Division of Revenue Bill. One of Parliament's core mandates is public participation. But also the Constitution makes provisions with regard to public participation in legislature, which you would find in Section 59, Section 72, and 118. The intention of public participation provisions in the Constitution is loud and clear: to influence government policy outcomes so that they reflect the will of the people. Therefore, a vibrant civil society plays an indispensable role in a democracy. Parliament provides a national forum for the public consideration of issues and facilitates the involvement of the public in the legislative process. We all know these are indeed challenging times for our economy, and all inputs are most welcome on how best to use the limited resources that we have. Your inputs and efforts are most valued and appreciated. With these few words, I would like to welcome you once more and also invite you to feel free to engage, but I'm looking forward to meaningful and constructive engagement that will add value to the work of the committee at the end of this hearing. Thank you very much. Apologies.
Good afternoon, Chairperson, members, and guests. We only received one apology for today's meeting, and it's from Ms. Lo Ntlangwini of the EFF. Thank you.
Honourable members, you accept my apology. Proceed to item number 3, which is presentation by South African Local Government Association. What do you say?
Thanks very much, Chairperson. And good afternoon to all members and everyone here. My name is Lindsay Zengwa. I'm here to represent SALGA. And we have submitted our position and our just meeting number 2, what we have here.
Please, in your presentation, you can talk to all the key issues.
In a nutshell, Chair, what Father wants to convey to the committee are four key things. But the report that we've been getting from the Auditor General and other investigations done by SWAG and the FFC seem to be painting a picture that says quite a number of municipalities are technically insolvent. That's a huge issue, given what local government is about to do. Secondly, quite a number of districts technically cannot run without transfers from national. We have raised an issue with our colleague, the Treasury, but also the fact that municipalities are currently owed 117 billion is the nature of national concern. And we can't be watching this debt growing on a year-to-year basis without boldly dealing with it. At some point, we all need to pronounce on what has to happen. Chair, these are some of the key issues that we want to reflect. But let me just go through the presentation quickly. The elections that we had last year ushered the fourth dispensation for our municipalities. Everyone did acknowledge, leading up to the elections, that there's still so much work that needs to happen in our local spaces. That also, how we this year collaborate around planning and resource allocation is the matter that's very key for all of us. And it is against that background, Chair and Honourable Members, that we've been engaging with our counterparts at Treasury, FFC and COFDA, to find solutions to some of the fiscal challenges encountered by the sector. It's also at the budget forum where we raised our issues, what we are saying today, but also in building up towards the budget that was presented by the Minister. Members may know that we had an elective conference late November last year, beginning December, which was well attended and elected new leaders for the sector. And as it happens in conferences, there were a number of recommendations and resolutions that we made. Of particular importance was the fact that our conference acknowledged some of the positive strides made in the sector during the previous term. Also that the report by Statistics South Africa on the financial and non-financial census of municipalities seems to point an increasing trend of services being provided by the sector. One of the most interesting developments, Chair, that members will note, is an instance, for instance, where the state has played quite a role in making sure that there's housing delivered. And interestingly, because of that initiative, you find also that province being one instance where most municipalities have been having challenges paying ESCOM. We can get to details of that. But I'm trying to point a correlation between services that are being put up by municipalities and the fact that this, in some instances, has left them in a financial difficult position. The report by the Auditor General over the past, you know, 3-4 years, all pointing a trend where most municipalities are being able to account for the resources that they are getting. For instance, one interesting observation is that 80% of the budget that goes to local government is spent in municipalities who have received clean audits. That negates
a general argument that local government needs to be spending its resources and the budget is not managed carefully. But also, the AG points out a very clear case where in more than 50% of municipalities, there are clear consequence management systems that attend to issues of unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless expenditure. So people are being held to account for how they manage local government resources. We are making a point here that given the context and where we're coming from, we do feel strongly as SALGA that alternative revenue instruments are necessary for the sector. I've raised the point that the debt currently standing at 117 billion does need to be attended to as a matter of urgency. The ability by municipalities to manage both debtors and creditors is also an item that we think we need to work with our colleagues at Treasury in attending to. White members may know about what municipalities owe to ESCOM. There's a whole list of other creditors that equally need to be attended to and paid accordingly. We've been talking about improving the client databases of municipalities so that services for the indigent are managed accordingly. And we've been raising an issue that says we need to be able within the sector to engage with the South African Revenue Services and other credit entities so that municipalities can have access to those databases and be able to track, you know, people accordingly. We did indicate in our last submission to this committee that we had SALGA jointly with the FFC conducted a study on what it costs municipalities to provide a basket of basic services. And this is a study that we've shared with colleagues at Treasury, and as we continue engaging, we'll be making that point that local government is currently underfunded and that we need to find a better fiscal dispensation for the sector. Now, talking about the Division of Revenue Bill, we do acknowledge, Madam Chairperson, the work done by Treasury in a very trying circumstances. And as we had participated in the crafting of the budget proposal, we do endorse and support the theme of transformation for inclusive growth, as was made by the Minister. And we note the various positive measures that were stated in the budget presentation. Some of the items that were raised by the FFC Chair, we want to again support them in their last report that they combined, especially on matters such as funding of rural municipalities, dealt with in Chapter 8 of that document. Chapter 9 also talks about transfers to districts. And again, I've made the point that we do need a better fiscal dispensation for districts. The point raised in Chapter 10 of the FF3 recommendation is also one item that we would wish that the committee takes note of. That, for instance, when people are evicted in farms, it is usually the burden of municipalities to resettle them when they may not have budgeted or have resources for that. Currently, it's not clear how that matter is dealt with because it's not taken as part of the disaster management grant. This is an area that we think could be improved. Okay. We do note again some of the following items that the expenditure for the sector is less by 10 billion. Secondly, that Chair, we make the following point that yes, the budget does substantially redistribute resources from urban centers to rural municipalities. It does again continue along the trend of subsidizing, you know, our poor households, and allocations are made to rural municipalities. One point that usually is not taken into consideration is the fact that though about 70% of debt revenue is generated in the urban centers, most of that revenue goes to small rural municipalities. We do support and encourage Treasury in continuing with that trend. That, however, still leaves us not entirely satisfied with the fact that municipalities or local governments will get only 9.1% of the total budget. That even though the grants have been reduced by 2.5 billion, yes, we note that the equitable share has increased by 5.1 billion. This is an area, again, that we've been working on how to better manage, you know, resources going to local government and how to change some of the grants that are in the budget. That's just the picture of what, you know, is currently going to local government. And you'll note, Chair, that the equitable share for local government is only 5% technically. The other 3% is made up of local government grants. Then there's 1% from the fuel levy. And then there's also indirect transfers to local government, which also stand at 1%. And given the enormity of the work to be done in municipalities, that picture is worrying to us. We raise it now over a number of years that we do need to reconsider how resources are allocated, especially for the sector. We note again that as we manage the allocations going forward, the game changers identified by the minister, we do agree with them. This being the introduction of the Standard Chart of Accounts, which will come into effect on the 1st of July this year. And we've been meeting with the Treasury to make sure that municipalities are ready and that those that are not ready are indeed supported so that they also comply with the MSCOA requirements. We support, you know, the improvements around supply chain, you know, processes. And again, this is an area that, as SALGA, we've taken keen interest on in making sure that municipalities, you know, do comply with the procurement requirements driven through the office of the Chief Procurement Officer. We know the issues around the revenue management and assets management that are also part of the game changers for this coming financial year. Now, I've said, Chair, that though we, by and large, you know, acknowledge the work done by Treasury in putting together the budget, some of our concerns have not entirely been attended to, as SALGA. I've raised or mentioned the issue of the cost of basic services study, and we've requested Treasury to consider what comes out of that document when allocations are made. And this is an item that, again, we'll take up at the budget forum. I've noted the issue that the 9.1% that goes to local government is an item that has always been of concern to us. We don't think that it is justifiable given the challenges and what needs to happen in the sector. We will again, during the course of this year, raise with Treasury, you know, issues around the traded services, especially the licenses that are granted by NERSA for electricity. So all these issues, Chairperson, require urgent intervention and require that we meet with Treasury and find one another and make sure that some of our proposals on these matters are taken care of. In conclusion, we will continue working with the FFC, COSTA and Treasury in making sure that some of the concerns that we've raised, you know, are given consideration and that perhaps the budget forum pronounces upon them, especially the matter of the increasing debt and some of the tariffs, you know, that are being charged in this sector. So in a nutshell, that is SALGA's view on the budget for this year, and they were willing to engage with the community and other stakeholders, making sure that some of the matters that we've raised are indeed taken care of. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Honourable members, the matter is now in your hands. I invite you to interrogate the presentation. Honourable Member Imam, and Honourable Member Dr. Madope, Honourable Member Manana, Honourable Member Nukwanyana, and Honourable Member Dr. Peek, Honourable Member Mr. McLaughlin, and Honourable Member Toba. If that's it, I'm sure you remember it. Yeah, okay.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start off by welcoming the presentation by SALGA. Alright, let me start off with, we talk about the solvency issue with regards to municipalities where many of them are insolvent. You perhaps are able to tell us which ones are insolvent, technically insolvent, and how much, what is their assets, what is their liabilities. What is your view in terms of the three-sphere governance? Does it really, in your view, work? Or do you think more responsibility should be given to districts who would be managing a smaller area and might be able to put more emphasis on service delivery rather than the provinces, which has the responsibility falling above the municipalities? And quite often we seem to have a problem where people are rioting on the streets because not much is being done, even though the budgets have been used. And I think you are aware that we are very good in spending our money. The only thing is we don't get value for money. Now, you talk about 80% of the budget going to municipalities where it appears there's very good governance, PFMA principles, and yet we find that we have so much of irregular expenditure, unauthorized expenditure. Would you be able to give us an idea of the number of officials in different municipalities that, I'm not sure if you will be able to hear them, maybe Treasury related can give us, that have been held not to comply in terms of that, or that have been charged and things like that. Now, you talk about the unviability of municipalities, and yes, that is a serious problem. What is your view in trying to encourage businesses? And I'm going to give you an example, and I think it happens in some of the other countries that we went and visited and came back, where if you take a business, and I'll give you an example, if you take Toyota South Africa, which is based in Itegwini, that Itegwini municipality should be one of the shareholders there and enjoy, and if you want to talk about addressing the inequality in South Africa, you know, based on what we've inherited, are we not able to get businesses that invest in these areas, that the municipality, viable businesses, can be part and parcel of that so that they enjoy the fruits of it, and in that way you'll be able to address the redistribution or the inequality, because 23 years later we are doing a lot. Not enough. You can see the gap is getting bigger by the day. So I would want to suggest, and I want your comment in terms of that. What do you think, or should we encourage something like that, where businesses, very successful and viable businesses, the municipalities buy into that, so it's a business transaction and they enjoy it, and that will help their viability. Or alternatively, are you saying that these municipalities that are going to be, that are not viable, should we rather amalgamate them with others and reduce the number of municipalities in the country like we're doing with demarcation, which is not always working into the best interest, but so that you decrease the, and that's why I'm going to the issue of districts, maybe greater responsibilities in terms of that. Chair, do you want me to give, I've got a few more, there's 17. Can I give my other colleagues, and if that is not covered, I'll come back to the others?
How many questions have you
asked? I don't know. I can always.
Okay, no, that's fine. If you want to make a follow-up, you will be afforded the opportunity
okay.
to ask questions. Alright?
Thanks, Honourable Chair. Thanks, Osvaldo, for the presentation. You raised the fact that you still own the municipalities for that point. What is the long-term plan for Osvaldo to try and retain and the municipalities don't own Eskom? Because also they are in a crisis, like the municipalities that we are indicating that they are being owned. And lastly, Chair, the second one, Chair, is around the issue of the municipalities and infrastructure. It has been a growing trend that the municipalities, they are not putting aside, the municipalities are not putting aside for infrastructure development in their budget. What would be your comment on that one? Because the government is saying we are talking about the debt that is it must be managed and so on, and the government is encouraging that we must in the government, any sphere of government must invest in the infrastructure so that we cannot invest in the operation budget, invest where you can get returns. What will be your comment on that? And lastly, you talk about the study that you have done with FFC. That you have, unfortunately we have not see that study. Is it possible, because when we motivate as a committee we must know the cost, because we talk about the cost of the basket services, to say it costs so much and you have interacted with Treasury, but we will request if you have a copy maybe to submit to the to our staff so that we can look at it, what is entailed in that particular study. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your intervention. Number three.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Also, let me join those who have welcomed the presentation. Let me touch by the Eskom issue. I'm raising it because I'm one of the residents who is being affected by this. I'm residing in Sugarligwa and Emalahleni, and both the municipalities are affected. You have indicated that you need to have a sustainable solution. Maybe you can share with us, what do you think, what is this sustainable solution that you are talking about? The second issue, we have raised a very serious issue that we need to find on the slide, there are no numbers. Find an alternative revenue instrument to enhance the financial viability and help municipalities. Are there any specific ideas that the SALGA would like to share with this committee with regards to that? The third one is with regards to the people who are owing different municipalities. What is your role in that? How can you assist the municipality to collect those who are owing those municipalities?
Thank you very much, Chair. And thanks for the presentation, sir. Some of the questions actually have been touched on, but I would like to first get a sense of the consequence management that you actually implemented, because you did say that there is a system of consequence management, and you added that, you know, they're made to account. What sort of actual penalties perhaps do you implement in order to ensure that this works? Then the other thing is the issue of ESCOM also, which has been touched on. You have a challenge of not being able to pay ESCOM, but on the other hand you also have problem of people not paying for your rates and taxes. I want to then also get a sense of how big is this debt in terms of government departments, because I know that government departments have also been culprits in this regard of not paying the municipalities. And when it comes to ESCOM, and especially in view of the NERSA decision to increase tariffs, what do you think about this? Do you think it is viable for the municipality to continue handling the electricity issue, or would it be better to give it to ESCOM, who I know also are experiencing problems because people are stealing the electricity? That is one thing I know. Even where I live, I know people just, I think, the other thing of this study that I wanted to also ask if you've got, the document, so that we can also go through the document and work on an informed position, having read what you've got in there. And just to finalize by saying, ASALGA, I imagine that they have a monitoring, very difficult monitoring role in terms of the performance of the municipalities. How hard are the challenges around monitoring the municipalities? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable
Doctor.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. Thank you for the presentation. You could be right that you are struggling and maybe you are not receiving enough money. It could be so, but there might also be things that you can do as well to assist with the, because it's mentioned in the presentation, Honourable Chair, the fact that there could be other sources of revenue, etc. So there are a few things that I would just like to raise, and I'm restricted to three for now. My first question would be from yourselves. Do you believe or think that municipalities can do more to contribute towards the economic growth? Because there are certain things that cannot necessarily and only be done by national government. If I think about things like attracting tourists, for example, I mean, that's an area where yourselves can, or SALDA, or the municipalities can attract tourists. So do you believe that is a possibility? And if so, to what extent is that contribution to economic growth being looked at and being the contribution being made? So that's one. And then I know the slides don't have numbers, but I've got the number 5 here, which I've numbered. Now, this is the one where you indicate in your presentation that you have 117 billion rands worth of debt, and then obviously you also have debtors. So people owe you money, and you owe people money. Now, in my view, and I'm not meaning to be harsh on this one, is that clearly there seems to be an issue with financial management, or credit management. That means so you're not getting your money from your debtors and you're not paying your creditors. So you're creating problems for yourself. I mean, it's you're right, and I want to just indicate the issue that I stated at the beginning. You should be, in my view, and my view might not necessarily count yet, but you could be getting more money from government, but you need to look after the money as well. So so therefore, that amount of 117 billion, who are your main creditors in that regard? And then I think this issue has been asked is, who are your main debtors? You also indicate, sorry Chair, just two more here. You also indicate on that page about profiling municipal plans. Now, I'm just a bit concerned about that one because as we know, you know, the situation in our country and in some of the municipalities, there are poor people. And even if you look at our past has resulted in people not having suitable credit profiles. So are you saying by doing that, that poor people who through no fault of their own are not going to be provided with your basic services like water and electricity because they have a bad credit profile? Question. And then lastly, Honourable Chair, is amendment number 14. And this one deals with the number three, the third point there that speaks to the municipalities need to set and collect cost-reflective tariffs. Now again, that's a dilemma that you face with, but it might create problems because now if you look at cost-reflective, how do you determine the cost, or rather, how do you determine the tariff? Is by looking at your cost, and some people might not be able to afford the tariff based on your cost. So therefore, what happens then is that your tariffs are then hopefully subsidized and you end up with a lower tariff. My question then is, will you not end up creating a backlog that when someday municipalities do well, and we hope that it does happen, that your tariffs will then be so low that they will not be able to cover the costs of the services that are provided? Thanks, Chair.
Honourable Member McLaughlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A lot of what I could have said has also been covered by my colleagues. What happens when you further down the list? In general, sir, perhaps I disagree with my colleagues to an extent, but I've always been of the opinion that 9% is not enough for local municipalities. That's my personal view. It's not necessarily a party political view, it's my personal view, having been in local government. And yet, I also know that most municipalities suffer from this malady where they're just unable to collect money that's due to them, particularly from areas where they feel the greatest political support comes from. And I think this needs to be addressed because we have a huge imbalance here. A lot of this money you say is owed to you. I know most of it, if I remember correctly, is from your own service receivers, if I can call them that. It's not necessarily from other government departments, although it's a substantial sum. Most of it comes from the people who you service, non-payment. Now, for those who register as indigents, I don't have a problem. That's why you get an equitable share to cover that base and so on. But I seriously think that municipalities everywhere would need to take very seriously the collection of money that's due. Not just cutting the service, because that doesn't pay for what's already due. It needs to come on board. I mean, you can't wait for everybody to sell their house and then recover it when they come and apply for a clearance certificate and say, well, now you need to owe us the 2 million you owe before we give you a clearance certificate, because in many instances they just can't do it. It's not possible. It needs to be a more practical issue. So, against that background, I just wanted to ask, you say that you had the Salga National Elective Conference in November, and the conference acknowledged that the positive strides were being made during the previous term and that a clear positive trajectory is beginning to emerge. Can you give us a little more information on that? So I'm not aware of this positive strides that you speak about. I want to know what positive strides these are and what is this positive trajectory that you're talking about. I'd like to get a bit more information about that. And then you speak as well of the positive trend of service delivery improvement. Well, if it's most service delivery in a municipality is of a financial nature because it costs the municipality money. So what do you mean when you say non-financial census? I'm not quite sure what you're saying. Is it just about the financial performance of the municipality, or is there something else you're referring to here? Because you know, if you're going to fill potholes, it costs money. If you're going to clean streets, it costs money. If you're doing any of those normal municipal functions, it all costs money. So I'm not quite sure what meant by non-financial. Perhaps you could just get us a bit better informed there. Now, the Audit general report showed an incremental trend of clean and unqualified audits. Audits of the two categories accounting for 80% of municipal spend. Now, can I just ask you, do you believe that this is because municipalities, with the help of the audit general, are getting better at box ticking? And that's the real result. That's what gives you a clean audit, because they now know how to address all the questions to satisfy the audit general. But they're not really addressing the problems in the municipality. The problems are still there. It's just that they're covered over better now. They're hidden better. Because I know this happens. So I know that the Auditor General spends quite a lot of time with the municipal managers with his management letter and sorting out all the problems before he actually issues his report. And a lot of those issues are addressed there. And I can see National Treasury laughing at me in the background there, but they was going to a municipality when the Auditor General's there and see, because it's happening on the ground as we speak. Which is why I asked the question. And then lastly, number five on that page, you say clear consequences management systems to deal especially with the UIF. Can you just explain what you mean by that? Consequence management systems to deal especially with the UIF. Please just broaden that for me. Give me an explanation. I think I'll have to stop there because I've probably asked my three questions. Thank you, ma'am.
Verifying my head, you commented this is number five.
No, it's number five on the page.
Oh, on the page. Okay, no, that's fine. Thank you very much, Mr. McLaughlin. And the Honorable Member Gavaza.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chairperson. It's appreciated that a lot of work has been going on between SALC and National Treasury and COFTA. To try and address some of the key challenges in the municipalities. What, however, I don't seem to quite hear clearly, and this is with regard to municipal revenue. What I don't seem to quite hear clearly, and it's an issue that we raised on Friday with National Treasury, is whether we could not find, are there no new technologies that would assist to facilitate collection of revenue? If there are, why have we not been pursuing that? So that we try as much as possible to resolve the problem that municipalities have of collecting revenue. I raise this because some people have been saying that there are better ways of, better technologies that can assist without you employing anyone to go and turn off, you know, the either water or electricity in any households, etc., and so on. The second part that is linked to that I don't quite hear quite clearly is this issue of illegal connections, which we have repeatedly raised. Illegal connections of water, illegal connections of electricity. And then, of course, now, I hear in my constituency, Chairperson, Tewini Metro, what looks like illegal upward extension of flats. And it is alleged that this is largely done by sometimes foreign nationals, and I don't want to sound like negative, but I mean it's a cause for concern in relation to just the building standards, so safety of residents, the legality around those upward extensions, again the implications of illegal connections, and so on. So it's an issue that that part needs to be investigated in the first instance. But I'm saying it's alleged that it is happening in the Etegwini Metro, and it comes from my constituency. So these are things that are I think are adding pressure on not just on the finances of the municipalities, but also on the urban infrastructure. The last question, Chairperson, is this issue of municipalities being owed and them owing Eskom as well. I thought that this issue was resolved at the time when National Treasury intervened, I think in the 2015-16 financial year. Is this a continuing problem, or it was resolved and then it's starting all over again, which means our solutions were not quite correct, if that is the case? Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. I will now cross over to Saga Rep to respond to the issues raised on your presentation.
Thanks, Chair. I'm going to try my best to respond to all the questions in the order in which they came. Yes, there's a couple of documents that we can share with members. All these are available and they are for public information. We've shared them with Fajari and other colleagues. The cost of basic services study that we did with the FFC. The non-financial census, it's a report by the Statistician General. They are not only looking at figures, you know, like in the audit, but they are looking at evidence of service delivery. How many houses were built in the study? How many people have got electricity connection? How many this and that? You know, that's what that report, you know, says. As I'm saying, it's done by the Statistician, you know, General. It's not a FOGA document, but we engage because it talks about, you know, evidence of what municipalities are doing with the money that they are given. There's the solvency issue. Again, it's a, you have got that. It's a document, you know, that is combined by Treasury from time to time to look at the financial state of municipalities. You know, Jan Hutting, yes, we'll have that. So again, members, you know, can have access to that information. It's a bit sensitive, but members can have an idea of which municipalities, you know, are listed there. The point about the three spheres, it's a difficult one. You know, it's not an issue that SALGA, you know, on its own can resolve. It requires some broader, you know, discussion on how to structure the state and so on. Suffice to say, there's an ongoing discussion led by COGTA on the powers and functions. And there's been information presented at MINMEC, for instance, that says in some instances, shouldn't we consider reviewing the Structural Act, where you may still have a district municipality with capacity but no category B municipalities under that district? Or you give more powers to a capacitated category B and you do away with the district where the district is not operating optimally. So there are those discussions that are currently happening. It doesn't talk to the province, I mean provinces and the other spheres generally. The UIF, it's a treasured language. It's not our language. We borrow that from you. It's the unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless expenditure. Just that we are using abbreviation. It's not the other Department of Labor UIF. The unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless, you know, expenditure. And we're saying the AG has picked up a number of cases, and they say in more than 50% of municipalities, there is evidence where council has taken officials through disciplinary, you know, arrangements, or some officials have been expelled, you know, by municipalities for mismanaging, you know, resources around those three areas. It's an audit language. The question of unviable municipalities,
it's an issue that is of concern to us, because they are not unviable because they chose to be unviable, but circumstances in their space. And as well, we've raised our concern that the demarcation instrument may not always be the answer or solution to some of these cases. We need to be more rigorous in our analysis of what the challenges are in those areas. And if intervention needs to be made through, you know, the national fiscus, we need to do that. You know, you can amalgamate municipalities, but you still, you know, have a situation where those new municipalities are themselves unviable. Already, we have those instances around the country, and that's one area where we want to engage COGTA and Treasury about support given to those areas, because the current 17.5 million is just not adequate at all to support demarcation issues. And then the ESCOM issue, let me deal with all of that broadly. 2015, there were all the challenges, and the Treasury intervened and compelled municipalities to make arrangements to pay ESCOM. And indeed, for first, there was initially a list of about 79 municipalities. All those municipalities, except for one, towards Nguate in the first state, all of them, you know, signed agreements saying that they are going to pay, and this is what they are putting on the table. 2 months later, quite a number of those municipalities were defaulting because the agreements that they signed were just not realistic. They didn't consider some of their cash, you know, management, you know, arrangements and pressures. So hence we're back to square one. So the matter was never entirely resolved, you know, honorable member. And still those municipalities, you know, especially in Free State and Mpumalanga, you know, that's where you have a large number. Now we have, as SALGA, been discussing this thing, and we've been meeting again with colleagues from Treasury, COGTA, ESCOM, you know, to get to the root of the issue. Currently, members, there's an interministerial task team that was established to run or to manage this matter. It's chaired by the Minister of COGTA. Then you have Treasury represented, you have Energy represented, you have ESCOM represented, and SALGA is also represented. You know, so we've been tailing proposals in terms of how to deal with the matter. That, for instance, some municipalities, if they were to collect 100% and give that to ESCOM, they will never be able to meet, you know, their month-to-month commitment to ESCOM. So again, there are issues just that are just, you know, unnecessary that need to be resolved. For instance, I know in the Free State and in Mpumalanga in particular, and I think ESCOM has been talking to the Eastern Cape as well, that ESCOM takes over the reticulation function. You know, and as SALGA, we've been very clear that we have a problem with that, because the reticulation function is a function that belongs to local government, not to ESCOM. ESCOM can provide that service only through a service delivery agreement, and that's what ESCOM has been refusing to do, to sign those service delivery agreements. You know, secondly, ESCOM has been charging municipalities only after 15 days, when municipalities themselves only collect after 30 days. And we've raised that with ESCOM, and they said they are willing to review that. ESCOM has been charging municipalities prime plus 5% on their bills, you know, on the 16th day if they haven't paid. And we've said that's just not acceptable. They can't go on like that. So hence you get a situation where the debt is just ballooning, made up of all the interest charges, made up of all the previous issues that were never resolved between the single municipalities. So we're hoping that ministerial task team will finally resolve the matter, and that we'll all find a sustainable, you know, solution to this. Yes, there's a requirement, honorable member, that municipalities must set aside about 8% of their budget, you know, for the infrastructure refurbishment. And we do encourage municipalities, you know, not to only manage, you know, what is, but also look at future investments, you know, for infrastructure, whether the money comes from, you know, the grants that they get, or, you know, it's from their own revenue sources. When we talk about alternative revenue instruments, we have made proposals, and we have published, I think, papers that talk about a number of instruments, one of them being pooled funding. and we've been introducing municipalities to that concept, to say you can club as municipalities, you know, pull together your balance sheet, you know, and find measures to put long-term infrastructure. We wanted to pilot that in Gauteng, you know, but we're taking the message to other provinces as well. We will be, as SALDA, running a conference, I think it's in October this year, on bonds. The city of Johannesburg, city of Cape Town, you know, have experimented with those green bonds and so on. And we think it's an instrument that we need to also take to other municipalities, introduce them to that, and make sure that where they can, you know, they leverage that instrument to get money to invest, especially in infrastructure. The amount, the 117 billion rand owed to municipalities comprises of households, and they constitute about 66% of that, and then we have government and private businesses, you know, making that total. We had an initiative at SALGA sometime last year, which we were running with Public Works, to make sure that they go all around the country, verifying exactly how much, you know, government owes, you know, to each of the municipalities, and where there are disputes about some of the bills, that those matters are attended to and resolved. And indeed, Public Works did pay close to about 1.3, 1.4 billion, you know, to some of the municipalities. But there's still a hooting for billion that still has not been paid. And Public Works has said they don't have that, you know, in their allocation. So we are busy discussing that because it does need resolution. We've been very clear again that where necessary, municipalities must, you know, effect their credit control, you know, policies. And if government is not paying, then they must just switch off government. If business and others are also not paying, municipalities must be very firm in implementing their credit control policies. The issue about profiling clients arises out of a situation where I will go and pay my TRS account, I will pay my Edgar's account, but I'm not paying my municipal bill. But because municipalities don't have access to that information, they don't know who's able to pay and who's not able to pay. So you find that there are indigent people that need to be supported, you know, and subsidized by municipalities, but also there are just people who are being delinquent in terms of not servicing or prioritizing their municipal accounts. And that's been our discussion with SARS, that if we know that someone is employed and is getting is getting a salary, then there's no way that that person should not be paying to municipalities, all of us. But also SALGA will be perhaps, Madam Chair, coming to Parliament at some point with some research that we're doing, that for us currently, if you work in a municipality or you're a councillor, you can't have your account, you know, not settled after 3 months. But our argument that we want to test is, why shouldn't that requirement apply to all state employees? Because we benefit from the same system. You know, we'll talk to Treasurer, we'll talk to Corporate Steve about that research, and we'll see if it's something that we cannot bring back to this Honorable House. The monitoring function, you know, of municipalities, members will remember that 2 years ago we launched what we call the Municipal Audit Support Program. So at any given, you know, time, we do know which municipalities are struggling, which municipalities have been getting disclaimed, you know, audit findings for the past 5 years, which municipalities are not spending accordingly, which municipalities have got problems with their records, you know, and assets registers and so on. So we do, you know, monitor, you know, the municipalities. Again, we do sit at treasury platforms where municipalities on a quarterly basis, you know, do come and submit reports on how they are performing, we call them Section 71 reports. We do keep those trends, and we do provide, you know, assistance accordingly when it is necessary. Yes, member, honourable member, municipalities must play a role in facilitating economic growth. SALGA started an initiative about a year ago, which we call Small Town Regeneration. So we go around, we had a session at the Karoo, you know, some few weeks ago, where we bring together all the old mining towns, you know, the small municipalities, you know, and we take them through measures to reconsider how they do planning, but also to consider measures, you know, innovations and so on that they can bring about to create economic livelihood, you know, in their spaces. So we are concerned about that and the fact that any municipalities or local government must contribute to economic growth and development. The cost reflective, you know, tariffs, it's just a budget issue. Because if you provide services for, say, a unit of electricity for 1 cent, yet you charge your clients 50 cents, then you are robbing yourself. The municipality will collapse, and your budget won't be cash funded, because you are being reckless in how you manage, you know, your treasury function. So I think to municipalities, it may not be always possible to subsidize everyone, but the policy, as far as we know it, says local government subsidize the indigent, not everyone. So all of us who can pay must then pay, you know, accordingly. We, towards conclusion, Chair, clean audits indeed do not always mean good service delivery. We have not said that, but where there are clean audits, chances of improved services are real. Because remember, the audit talks to three issues. How has the municipality been managing its finances? How the municipality has been complying with all laws and regulations, but also how has the municipality been performing on the targets that they had set up front. So chances are that when you spend and you spend within the acceptable terms, you know, you would have been doing something, and I think there seems to be some correlation between what SSA and the AG has been finding in a number of the municipalities. On the last technology question, Dr. Thomas, we work with the South African Cities Network and the COPTA to investigate a technology instrument that could see municipalities improving their revenue, you know, collection measures. Been looking at a number of models, and we had agreed as SALGA that this is an initiative that we would want to take. But then COPTA went ahead and they issued out a tender sometime last year. Now that's where we are. You know, it doesn't seem to be clear to us how they are moving forward with that. But COPTA took it upon itself to advertise and seek, you know, capable entities who can provide, you know, the sector with the technology instrument to improve revenue collection. There is a study again that we had done, you know, at SALGA on the billing systems. You know, we looked at what is working and what is not working. And we've been taking that to municipalities, you know, engaging officials, you know, in terms of how to improve, you know, their revenue collection, you know, practices. I think I've covered by and large, except the point about illegal connections. I think it's an issue that needs more enforcement by municipalities in terms of their bylaws. There must be certain standards. You can't just have a building extended without a plan having been approved. So how municipalities monitor those, you know, cases, and how then they deal with the cases of breach of the planning laws, you know, it's something that we would say local government must do. You know, we need to build that planning capacity, that zoning capacity, and make sure that no illegal, you know, connections and extensions, you know, are allowed. I think by and large, unless there's some items that are missing, Chair, I'll be guided.
Your follow-up, because remember we've got two other presentations and we must give them also enough time for engagement. So in your follow-up, I'll allow you two follow-up questions. How many?
Thank you, Chair.
Want to raise follow-up questions?
No, that's fine.
They're the only ones. And then I will raise two questions for them.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Thank you for that presentation. I just wanted to know what role you are playing in terms of capacity building of councillors, because there seems to be a problem on the ground of lack of commitment from public representatives, and especially councillors, and that is why you find
a lot of what happens in terms of this rioting and things is because there is no that contact and that communication is not there. That is that's the one. I'm a little bit concerned about what Salga is saying in terms of ESCOM. You know, let's look at it from another angle. ESCOM is a kind of a business entity which needs to generate its own income. It has huge debts which it needs to pay, it borrows. Now, municipalities buy electricity from ESCOM. They must pay ESCOM. How they get their money, where they get their money, if you look at it from a business perspective, they must pay. Now, I know that the municipalities have a problem, very serious problem. It's not only about those that don't pay, but it's also this issue of the theft of electricity is a massive problem which they can't seem to handle. But now the fact that it falls under the municipality, surely it can't be ESCOM's responsibility. Now you are saying that ESCOM, and I know when ESCOM wants to disconnect, people are shouting, they're screaming. But now if we look at it from their point of view, what are they expected to do? What do you suggest that they do in terms of a collaborative effort together so that it can be a win-win situation? They need their money. Municipalities are by large not being able to pay because of the theft. It's not only about people not being able to pay. I think the other issue of 15 days and 30 days, like you said, those are matters that you can sit at the table and find a solution. But remember, ESCOM is also paying a lot of interest time. And let's not forget that as well. So I don't know if you, I'll leave the others out if you can just on that.
In my case, on your, that is not enough, background, where you talk about your conference, among others, resolved upon any bit of the whole list, your message. I know that the conference was on the 28th of November to the 1st of December, maybe 3 months down the line, and then you resolved. What plans do you have to implement, and also the time frame? Because, as you can see, we desperate for solutions to help. For instance, you talk about alternative revenue instruments, and that is an issue. To say municipalities need to be assisted to improve their revenue collection. So you are so.
But this is another alternative.
what you would have to work out is whether it is the best alternative or not. Garnishing the department just to assist the municipalities. I think that's that's all that I wanted to raise with you. Yes. Over to you, sir.
Thanks, Chair. We had elections, local government elections, on the 3rd of August last year. And immediately after those elections, not to remember, SALGA embarked on a countrywide induction process for all councillors. All of them, new councillors, returning councillors, all of them were inducted. After we went through that program, there's an initiative again now to induct them per portfolio, because we wanted to allow them time to, you know, spread themselves to various committees in the municipality. For instance, in our space, we'll be doing induction for all councillors on finances, you know, how to oversight, you know, municipal budgets, how to understand financial statements, what questions to ask, and all those issues. So there's that program that we're going to be running out. You know, in a number of instances, we've already had some cases where, for instance, some municipalities will invite us and say, we have this urgent need. We're supposed to be interacting with the Auditor General, but we don't know what questions we must ask as the MPEC. And we've taken them through, you know, financial statements and escort.
I see that you are interacting the meeting.
Right. We've made a very clear point as well that ESCOM is a national asset, and it's not right that ESCOM is not paid. So all those who get benefit of, you know, electricity from ESCOM must pay. But we've said just as well, there are issues that are not necessarily just about ESCOM and SALGA, but they are about the country and how we run the electricity business. That, for example, most municipalities rely on electricity for revenue more than any other service. So how you deal with the electricity matter is very important for the sector. Secondly, there are areas where ESCOM does regulation. And was saying it was incorrect for NERSA to grant ESCOM licenses outside municipality, because that's against the law. And we said as SALGA, should it be necessary, we can take that to the Constitutional Court for review, so that we get a very clear indication on who should be doing what in terms of law. But we allowed the process of the Interministerial Committee to continue to find resolution to those issues. Where municipalities don't have capacity, we've recommended that yes, indeed, they can contract ESCOM, but there must be a deliverable agreement signed between the municipality and ESCOM. You know, but just as well, municipalities are losing billions because they can't levy surcharges on those areas where ESCOM is regulating. And those are some of the problems, you know, that we've been talking about and put on the table. And all of us, you know, are trying to find. So ESCOM has been positive to some extent, and they said, yes, maybe this thing of charging, you know, interest after 15 days, you know, doesn't make sense. We'll review that. They said, yes, instead of charging prime plus 5, maybe that doesn't make sense. We'll review that. So they have also at least moved, you know, some distance and trying to meet us halfway on these items. The conference was in December. We're not even talking about the resolution currently. We're talking about a program, because we translated all those, you know, conference resolutions into deliverables. And so most of the issues raised in the presentation are ongoing, you know, programs that SALGA is currently running with, you know, on all these matters that we said they were resolved upon by the conference. We have an annual plan and with a clear delivery target. And us as administrators are mandated by the NEC to make sure that all those resolutions are indeed translated into action plans for execution by the sector. When we talk about lobbying, that has been the question that we were all asking. If we say we want more money for local government, how much would that be? And for what purpose particularly? And hence then the cost of, you know, our basic services study seeks to address, you know, in response to that question, to say for the municipality to offer water services, this is how much it costs per household. So it gives a breakdown and it does talk about, you know, the figures. Yes, there might be issues between that study and the formula currently used to put together the equitable share, but we are open about having frank conversations with Treasury on those items. And we're hoping that as we continue meeting at the budget forum and in other platforms, you know, we will see eye to eye around some of those issues. I think those were the issues, ma'am. Then my colleagues can talk to the last question about deducting money.
This is quite a complicated question, and there's a number of issues that we need to keep in mind when we consider this proposal. For example, there are already some of the initiatives underway to see actually how Treasury can play quite a key role in assisting municipalities to pay their arrear debts. So, for example, we've got it's not just debt owed by national government departments, there's also debt owed by provincial departments. And both in respect of national government as well as provincial governments, largely the biggest owner is the Department of Public Works, both in national government as well as in provinces. So what a number of provinces have done is actually to keep money in their own coffers to ensure that the provincial departments that own municipalities, that that money is then paid over by the provincial treasury to the municipalities concerned. So that's one of the initiatives underway that's already trying to assist in that regard. As some previous indicators, there's also an initiative at national level where national treasury, SALDA, COCTA, Department of Public Works are working together. So the agreement that was reached there is that all national government departments agree to pay what they call the principal debt, but there's also quite a lot of disputes regarding some of the debt, because not all properties are clearly allocated and some of the properties are under dispute. So there's a bit of cleaning up that's required to be done there. So definitely both the National Treasury together with the Provincial Treasury can play quite a key role to assist in actually dealing with the arrear debt. But the line is quite fine, because National Treasury can also not act as a credit collector, because then we're actually blurring the lines as well. So yes, we are looking at issues of how we can assist, but we can't go too far overboard, because then we become credit collectors, which is also not our responsibility.
Remember, it's not credit collection, it is punishment or reduction of what is owed,
municipality,
and then transferring it, because you have the power, you have the influence on budget allocation. So that the departments can learn to pay. They don't want National Treasury to deduct. They must pay on their own. Maybe we can enter into an arrangement, payment arrangement, just like we do when we've got accounts. Well, that's credit. Credit control. Okay, so that's fine. All right. Thank you very much. Honourable members, I'm sure you are happy with the responses. And we can now move on to the next presentation. Am I reading the situation correctly? Agreed?
Yep.
Agreed. All right. Thank you so much, sir. You can see the level of engagement. You really triggered a discussion. Your presentation triggered a constructive discussion with possible solutions. Thank you. We will now move over to a presentation by Rural Health Advocacy Project. Over to you, sir. If you can again introduce yourself so our members can know you better.
Unfortunately, we're knocked out. My name is Russell Rainsburg. I'm with an organization called the Rural Health Advocacy Project.
Okay, my name is Russell Greensburg. I'm with the Rural Health Advocacy Project, and our presentation today is really just how we allocate or how we fund health, and where we feel from a rural perspective there are some opportunities for growth. I think maybe just to talk to what Madam Chair was saying about earlier, we fully acknowledge the situation that we find ourselves in with declining budgets, with like the post-2008 financial crisis and a fair amount of uncertainty around the world. I think we're all aware that that is largely left to lower economic growth, lower tax receipts, which kind of puts pressure not just on government revenue, but everybody's revenue at the end of the day. I think the situation is somehow exacerbated, where our expectations as a public and maybe our support as government is not in line with what our ability is at this point in time. And I think low growth and then generally this whole scare around the ratings created this response where we as a government and as a people had to come to terms with this new concept called fiscal consolidation. Essentially, from what we pick up from the budget papers is that we're prioritizing debt repayment, right, and limiting public expenditure and then focusing on key risks. Right? We've seen that in last year's medium-term budget statement, and again now in the budget statement, that we've started seeing a reduction in the overall amount of money available to government to do its business. And we think that from when we start doing that, it obviously starts bringing the question about how we're allocating our money and are we allocating it in the correct way. Now, as some of you are well aware, that the health allocation is split between national and provincial spheres. Not so much local government anymore, which is the ambit of environmental health, which for some health professionals is not considered health, wrongly. And then if you look at the provincial health expenditure review over the last 10 years, we've had a growth in health expenditure at least by 1.3% in real terms. That's when we consider normal inflation and not necessarily medical inflation. When we look at medical inflation, then the amount is probably below inflation. The expenditure is driven largely by the ART program, which dominates health expenditure, you know, to the detriment of other public health priorities. But it's not a spending that we can argue away, but definitely a necessary spending. But when we reflect back on the growth in health and expenditure, we factor in the fact that we're spending more on drugs for ARVs and the like, we are essentially underfunding other aspects of the health system. Health budgets outside of the ART program are still under significant pressure. You know, it's driven a lot by higher drug prices and the cost of employment. But you must understand the cost of employment increases will always occur when the budget starts shrinking. So if you have a smaller budget and the same staff complement, the percentage that's contributing, the percentage of employment that's contributing to the overall budget seems higher, but the budget's slightly curtailed. But health is not a business where we make baked beans. There are very specialized skills there, and they aren't easily replaceable. But what we started seeing last year, and in this year, in Stats SA's report on the causes of death, was the emergence of what we call of lifestyle diseases, such as diabetes, hypertension, and so forth, contributing quite a significant portion to causes of death. In some instances, like, and it's not necessarily just limited to our richer municipalities or districts. The one that caught my eye was Oliver Tambo District in the Eastern Cape, which is one of the most deprived districts in the country. And the contribution to death of diabetes and hypertension and other non-communicable diseases was at the same level of HIV and TB, which is significant. And if you've looked at some of our earlier statements, we feel that health expenditure, I'll probably get to it now, if we don't explicitly plan for these changes in the disease burden and continue the focus just on HIV, we could be sitting in a situation where we're creating a new pandemic, which is going to cost a lot more money to fix because we pick it up too late. We also saw this year, with loud applause, and particularly from us as well, is the actual launch of the National Health Insurance. The minister, in his budget speech, spoke about the NHI fund targeting or being introduced for particular key populations like mothers, the elderly, disabled people, and so forth. And for us, that's almost like a Rubicon moment, because now we'll get to see exactly what we mean by the fund and what the impact of this fund will have on healthcare delivery. What's not clear to us, though, is what is the role of provinces and districts within this fund. What is the introduction of the fund going to do? Is it going to mean a net increase in expenditure? Or will we see a further deterioration of public services like we did with the introduction of private medical care, where, in a sense, we're spending all our money on private care and under-investing on public health care? So I think part of our submission here is to get a better understanding in how the single purchaser model will work, right? And what is the potential transition period or impact plans for what it will do to the public service. Now, the provincial equitable share also featured quite strongly in this year's budget, where I think the minister in his speech went to great lengths to explain the redistributive potential or what it does in distributing revenue from those who have it to those who don't have. But we also last year made a submission around our issue with the health component and how that health component relies a lot on historical expenditure. As you would note from my earlier slide where I spoke about the rise in non-communicable diseases, we're picking up the deaths, but we're not spending enough on prevention. And if people aren't presenting at the clinics with those conditions, then we're not accounting for them. So they're not included in our district health plans or our plans or means to address because we don't really have the funding for it. Again, we say our budget allocations are heavily influenced by historical utilization rates. And for me, the risk equalization component that you talk about in health is not as clear, but I'm not that technical, and I'm hoping that through our submissions to this committee, we'll maybe get a more layman's understanding of what that equalization component of the formula really means. Again, I'd like to refer back to the higher mortality rates in non-communicable diseases, which are sometimes also considered diseases of lifestyle. And I think we spoke a little bit about the introduction of the sugar tax as a possible measure, but as you know, in South Africa, we don't believe in ring-fence taxes. Right? So when we collect that tax becomes part of the national fiscus and gets distributed to the normal distribution mechanisms like the DORA. So we don't, and as it stands at the moment, it doesn't raise that much money to really counter the effects of non-communicable diseases. And I think this is a growing epidemic that we need to see whether we are correctly tooled for. Now, for us, the big challenge comes in over our year. Over the last couple of while, we spent a lot of time working on the provincial equitable share formula and then started following the money as it goes down the system. Now, as you'll know, the provincial equitable share formula is very well documented. There's components for health, there's components for education, for economic development, and so forth, etc. And all of these formula contribute to an allocation of resources to the provinces. But to date, we actually haven't found a similar mechanism at province level about how that money gets distributed. Right? In treasury documents, they'll tell us that province is closest to the point of delivery, so they know best what the priorities are. And because the grants are unconditional, premiers and provincial legislators can determine their own priorities. Right? And unfortunately, what often happens with that, and I can speak for health, is that we start seeing things like district health, which is really just the cornerstone of healthcare delivery within our country, becoming underfunded. Right? Because there's no particular form to say that there's no ring fence money to say there's particular district health services in this way. So instead what we've seen these like ad hoc cost containment measures, we've seen like a tailing on hiring, not filling vacancies as they become available, because by far that seems to be the easiest cost containment measurement is not to fill a vacancy. But the long-term impact on the system is much higher, and I think we've argued quite strongly on that, and we thank the committee for also taking those recommendations through into the minister's responses to Parliament on the budget. Now, again, it's a beautiful treasury document that looks at health or provincial expenditure from 2001 to 2014. And over that time, we can see how this health expenditure has grown and grown and grown. And that growth kind of correlates with how we've expanded our HIV program. Right? Currently, we have over 3.5 million people on treatment, and we're aspiring to, by 20, if the National AIDS Council is anything to go by, all the allocations that we make in the outer years of the medium-term expenditure framework, is to have 5 million people on treatment. Now, once they're on treatment, they're in the system forever, so they require support. So in a sense, we should be expecting to spend more on our service delivery platform, given that we're going to have such much higher utilization. Instead, what we're seeing is a leveling off of expenditure on core operational budgets. This is problematic because it puts at risk a number of major investments that the country has made. The first of those being the investment in HIV treatment. 5 million in 3 years' time, 6 to 7 million in 8 years' time. Right? But we're not spending more on improving the health service delivery platform. We're not spending more on training effectively different service level users. And we're neglecting sometimes more homegrown interventions in human resources for health, like community health workers, by undervaluing the contribution that they can make. And while we, as the Rural Health Advocacy Project, are totally in favor of the Minister protecting frontline health posts, what's problematic is that we don't allow for future growth. So what our operational budgets aren't in line with our investments. So why rural? And why should we consider rural in any other, any different from any other city? Experience where most of the people is, and your logic will tell you that's where you have most of your impact. Now, as many of you know, I'm a rural boy. I come from a small town outside Humansdorp. So Humansdorp was the big town, from a place called Blue Lily's Bos in the Eastern Cape, I think population 200 when they last counted. But the rural, most of us have a rural genesis. Over 40% of our population currently reside in rural areas. And if you look at the people that trek back every year or every other big holiday, there's a fair amount of migrant intra-provincial and intra-country migration to rural areas, so we have a base. Secondly, unlike the situation maybe overseas, if you look at our rural population demographics, over 60% of them are young people. You know, they under 25, they're at school, they're looking for opportunities. And sadly, of that 60%, more than half are young women who in this country continue to be at the risk of economic exploitation in the first instance. They're at risk of contracting HIV at a higher rate than anybody else. Right? And it would make sense that we should actually be spending more of our developmental budget in the rural districts than what we do elsewhere, because there's not many alternatives available to people living in the rural areas. So recent statistics also tell us that 6 out of every 10 people in the rural areas live below the poverty line. You know, there was a SA Treasury document that came out in the preamble to the 2015 budget, which kind of still sits with me, where they say that more than 60% of households in South Africa survived on less than 3,500 rand per month. That's a household of 6 people, which for some of us is our petrol bill every month. And when we look at how we deliver services in rural areas, I think that's where we have to apply the gold standard to make sure that we give everybody an opportunity to fully enhance their capability. Right? What we've seen also now is this underfunding of rural health districts through moratorium on posts, inadequate operational budgets, and compromising to a large extent our capacity to deliver. Currently, the district health expenditure review is not part of the document that gets sent through to the Auditor General when they review the problem. And from our own accounts, we've started seeing district health expenditure reviews, which looks at expenditure on district health. And there's a serious build-up of what they call unfunded commitments or accrual. And when you look at them a little bit more closely, it's just essentially their operational things that they have to do. You know, it's not necessarily bad financial management. It's just that there's a fixed set of services that are delivered by a clinic or a district health center or whatever. And when that budget gets reduced, the rise in unfunded commitments, particularly on things like medicines and so forth, goes up. You know, what we're doing again, we're compromising this investment that we're making in the NHI, that we're making in the treatment expansion, as well also in the National Development Plan, where we aspire for a health system that works for all. But all our actions are contrary to that at the moment. We're actually weakening our ability to respond and to the needs of our most vulnerable people. So what we are here today is maybe talk or start a conversation around not just looking at the provincial equitable share formula, but also sort of broadening the discussion and saying, should we have equitable provincial health allocations within the province, and what is the role of national in informing them? The first thing for us is unmet needs. you know, where we feel at the moment the system, because of its historical nature and because of its supply side nature, we tend to only fund the things that people present with. And we don't ever get about those things outside of the system. This non-communicable disease thing is a big thing, and I'm sorry if I'm going on about it all the time, but it speaks specifically to the way that we live up, the way that we account for our lives now. Most of us will assume that poor people don't drink sugary drinks, that people in rural areas don't have, we just have this myth that rural people will have healthy diets, but that's not the case because they have the same challenges that we do in the cities. We have to look at geographical remoteness, like how do people access services? I think that was one thing that came through to me from the SALGA presentation, is that we have these multiple layers of service delivery in districts and municipalities and even and provinces, and we're all sort of playing in this other space. But we really sit down and think about how do people most in need reach our services? We have to look at things like population size, density, and demographic characteristics. I told you earlier about the amount of young women living in our rural areas who will be coming to the cities at one point. And we make them more vulnerable by underdeveloping rural. There was a study that came out last year from an organization called SASPRI, which have been tracking deprivation and they're used by the Department of Social Development, amongst others. And what they did was they sort of like looked at deprivation, which looks at access to services, access to educational opportunity, employment, etc., and then scores people. And what they found was that, you know, the bulk of our deprivation is actually concentrated in our former homeland, particularly in the Eastern Cape and KZN, right? And as well as in the northern parts of our country. And what was sad was that 21 years into our new democracy and our new plan, the areas that we had underdeveloped before, we continue to underdevelop, be it a lack of capacity or be it maybe not an understanding of how important capability is in driving us forward as individuals and lifting our communities. I think this last week we heard from the people at UCT. We had a wonderful doctor from East London and another one born in Mthatha who met actually some genetical conditions around heart disease, which they are putting at the same level of what Chris Barnard and others did in the first heart transplant. And those are rural boys. But if we reflect back now in 2017, how many rural children will be able to access an education system or a health system that will take them to the place where they can perform at that level? I can speak for myself. Being born in 1970, I was lucky enough to sort of grow up through the transition to the new democracy. And I came from a rural district to a council house in Bloemendal in Port Elizabeth, and ultimately to a point where I could actually operate as a professional. So the new democracy has been a gift to me. When I go back to my neighborhood now, I don't see that many kids being able to access those same opportunities. And I think, for me, that is the core purpose that drives our work, is that why we all do what we do is so that individuals can have the capability to be able to move or have a pathway out of poverty. And then lastly, this is the issue that Stephen commented on last year when he spoke about SALGA and FFC's cost of services study and the flaws in the methodology. But I think it is something that we need to start considering, is looking at cost adjusters and realizing that we're not delivering services in a uniform way. You know, the developmental context or the context of where we deliver services is different in every situation. And I think to a point we need a level of devolution as we come up with new basic cost ingredients and start reflecting on that as a community better. And then I'd like to close with a quote around equity and priority setting, because in a sense now when we have limited money, we also have limited opportunity of doing everything. Right? Priority setting of health intervention should seek first of all to achieve health system goals, which for us is a better life for all. Broadly defined as maximization of health, reduction of inequalities in health, and financial protection against the costs of ill health. So my closing question to you is, are we setting the right priorities? Are we funding in the most effective way? And if not, what are the platforms that we can create in order to fund better so that those people that are the least developed and the most vulnerable can also share in the spoils of our growth? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Fred, for the presentation. Honorable members, without any waste of time, I'm going to ask you to come in.
Honourable Member Imam. Honourable Member Snukwanya. Okay, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for that presentation. Chair, I gave my colleague a chance to go before me, but he declined. I want to start off by acknowledging what you're saying, and especially that specific area you're talking about, Blue Lilies, where you come from. But it's a very badly neglected area if you talk about Mandela Park, Sipsikama, Storm the River, Thornham, Coldstream. Very badly neglected, and I know there's a serious challenge with HIV and unemployment and teenage pregnancy in that area. And I must also agree with you that I think the problem that we're sitting with non-communicable diseases in the country, I think, is underestimated. And on the one hand, I know the minister is very sincere about talking about prevention rather than the money that we are spending. But it's a mammoth task out there, to be honest with you, given the socio-economic conditions of people, like, because there's a whole lot of factors that contribute to what is actually really the problem. But the issue of diabetes and hypertension, and I must tell you, it is fast becoming the number one killer in the world. And I agree with you, it's going to exceed HIV and everything. Do you have any stats for us in terms of the percentage that is being spent in municipalities, specifically on HIV and things like the ARV treatment, compared to the other health challenges in the area, and specifically which areas, in your view? I know that it's going to be, I don't think you're going to be able to give too much because it's saying too much, and I think being a disease like HIV, which got its stigma, it's not easy to, you know, to give certain information. But I think what is very important for us is to see, and I think the picture we want is that, and I know you're talking about budgeting, where there's a problem that there's not enough being given to the rural areas and certain areas. It is also because we don't have enough information as to what the challenges of specific areas are. And I must agree that once it is allocated, it comes with the strategic plan from the provinces and the region. There is no control over that. After that, it's lost. And I think it's a serious problem. But if we can get that more information onto needs of those rural communities in terms of that, then yes, we even as this committee can play a greater role in ensuring that it is diverted, you know, into the correct areas. So I want to really agree with you in terms of that. Now, and I think one thing that is coming out very clear again is the importance of district health compared to even provincial. It's very important. Size is a number, you are more in touch with the people, and I think it's very important. And I know there was a report at one stage in terms of how some of the district health were performing. But again, I agree with you that what is going to happen if those budgets are not directed correctly to those districts, there's going to come where the entire system is going to collapse. I think even for us, there is a challenge in terms of the NHI at the moment, because we too not 100%, we're not sure as to, you know, where the provinces are going to fit in the district. And I think once that has come, we will be there. But what is in your view, what do you think, or what is it this committee, and I think you know and appreciate what is the responsibility of our committee is to follow the budget. And we are able to recommend in terms of the proposals that are put here. So if you can just tell us what you recommend or suggest the role that we can play, you understand, in assisting to try and create that better environment in those districts and things. If you can tell us that, and I think we will quite be prepared to assist that. Chair, I'm going to give my other colleagues and then I'll come back. Thank you.
Honourable Member Mubanyan.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair, and thank you very much for the presentation. I'd like to start perhaps by just speaking to the issue of provinces, the allocation to provinces and their role. Like to say that they use their own discretion, you know, to decide on programs and projects. My understanding is that the provinces exist precisely for this purpose, so that whatever decisions are decentralized, but whilst we recognize that national must always be there to monitor and to provide policy direction and all that. So I would imagine that it is a good thing, even local governments, because they are nearer to the people and they would know
their provinces better. But I agree with you that the area of rural development does pose a lot of provinces. Maybe like my colleague, it would also help just to have an idea of what exactly increased. Because I'm telling you why I'm also saying this, because in as much as we're saying rural health, you know, for me, rural health cannot be a standalone. Because with rural development, we do need an integrated sort of approach. You can't, for instance, we can't speak of clinics and hospitals without speaking about basic service, water and sanitation, housing, you name it, and all those things will actually contribute towards the status of people's health in the rural area. The issues that you raise, such as non-communicable disease, in fact, most of those things that you raise, they apply across the board, whether it's urban or rural. But for obvious reasons, rural areas would obviously be the bigger losers, as they are in most instances. And I think the approach maybe that we need to get, I think that he's saying we need to just get a little bit more information, because here we're doing it, you are presenting so that we can understand and be able to take up issues on behalf of rural health. And obviously, as provinces also vary, there are those that are far from being rural, but there are those that are highly rural. And then you've got all sorts of challenges, like some of which you have mentioned, like distances from services and all that. And it would help us to get a little bit more detail as far as the motivation, because this is, to me, a motivation for better resourcing of rural development. I'd rather use the word rural development actually than rural health, because I think it needs rural development for us to be. Then the other thing that I just noted, you were saying that when taxes are collected, then they go to the national revenue fund. But do you think it would help to say if you collect, you keep it yourself? What about those people that are not able to collect anything? So I just wanted to say that I would imagine that it's a good idea, as long as the redistribution would be fair, because there are those people who will never be able to collect. I'll end this session.
Thank you. And then, Honourable Member Shopesole, Honourable Member Mamloki, Honourable Member Dr. Pink, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to thank the presenter. This is an eye-opener. And I agree with you in most of the emphasis on the importance of district health. But I just wish, Chairperson, before you disappear, that we could call these people in the presence of the Department of Health. And maybe we should gain some understanding, especially on the national health insurance, you know. And because after 20th January 2017, after Trump's announcement, I think most of American companies like USA have been called back home. And I think I cannot say for a fact, I wish the department was here. It has affected our Department of Health in such a way that, you know, other countries are seeing the vacuum. Countries like Japan, and they are coming in with their own thing, which may sometimes twist our NHI a little bit in favor of their own national health, which may be a problem for us. But I also want to be comforted by Treasury, because they are here, to assure me once again that when you talk about fiscal consolidation, you are in no way thinking of austerity measures, because that one, it's it's just scary to me. You know, Professor Joseph Stiglitz, even as of last week, was talking about it, how dangerous that thing is, and how destructive, how it has destroyed the EU, Greece, and other. So I want every time when you talk about this fiscal consolidation, it must not be a sugar-coated phrase to make me comfortable. It must really not be austerity. Thank you.
Was it Dr. Fick? Next?
I think it was me.
Okay.
Was it? Mr. Rensburg, thank you. Yes. Can I just ask you, maybe I'm missing the point here somewhere, but the title of your presentation is "It's Time to Fix the Way We Fund Healthcare." Your presentation tells us why we should do that, but I didn't see a lot of the how we should do that in it. Perhaps your second last slide, you may argue, is that's the how, the one headed towards equitable provincial health allocations, but that's just the spread. That's how the money that's available should be divvied up. But as Appropriations Committee, what are you asking us to change in the funding of healthcare? I didn't really get anything clear out of your presentation. Forgive me at that. Maybe that I wasn't following your argument properly. But can you maybe just give me a thumbnail sketch on that one? And then I would just like to ask you, is there any empirical evidence that you know of that the, what, to use your words, the rising burden of non-communicable diseases, is that percentage increasing at a greater rate than the population is increasing? In other words, should there be an ever-increasing percentage of the budget allocated to healthcare as a result of such things, or should we just be keeping pace? Thank you, Chair. That's all I have.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. My input is slightly different, and not sounding as though I'm disagreeing with my colleague. But first of all, it's a simple presentation which gives us what your problems are, and clearly there are problems, and it's simple probably because you're from PE, the same place where I'm from, so that's why you've given such a good presentation. But having said that, in my view, you know, it's simple. You've given, instead of coming with a 70-page document, you've come with a problem. We don't need too much. We need you to fix it. And I am tending to think that now that we are armed, maybe the issue now is that we need to look at where and how you can be assisted or rural development. Although, having said that, you know, when I look at the figures, it's scary, it's startling. I mean, 40% of countries of the population resides in rural districts. Now, that's going to be a serious problem to solve, and I would really not want to be the one that's going to look at the solution. It's really... So I'm agreeing with you, except something that I would like to add is that looking at the last audit report, the Auditor General's report, health is one of the departments that has underspent their funding. So, you know, it's problematic. So you have a problem there. You're needing funding, and funding is given. And I'm not saying that it was given to rural health, but having said that, if they couldn't use it, then surely maybe we need to talk to the people that are not spending the money and first punish them. And once you punish them, then take the money away from them. But yeah, I'm saying that we need to look at a solution, and I would support your trying to solve your problem.
Honorable Mathoka.
Thanks, Chair. Well, I wanted to check. It is true that we are all uncertain about the details of the NHI, as you also indicated. But I want to check, you also raised the concern around the cut or the monitoria that has been put in the, yes, in the, what would be your comment when we are saying the Treasury has said they can motivate for those positions that are critical in their work? Because it's not like the Treasury has just said no.
but they said if there is a position that is critical for the work, the department can, you know, motivate. That's why I want to support the Honorable Triple S behind me. Shop. Sheila Shop is it all. To say that maybe if the department also is here, because I think the Treasury has made that provision. It's not like it's closed. But also, what is your view around the Rural Health Advocacy Project termination on NHI due to the lack of performance?
Thank you,
Mr.
Chair. One small question, which perhaps we may not necessarily ask now, but perhaps it's something that you could go and have a look at. If you do have some answer, yes, indeed, by all means. The you know one always worry about a belief that throwing money into every problem solves the problem. And therefore, I'm tempted to ask whether we shouldn't really be focusing on the quality of healthcare. In the rural areas with whatever amount of money there exists. And of course that quality of health care would further expose other needs that might require then us going back to the money. So putting money first sometimes becomes a problem. But you may respond.
Thank you, Chair. I think I'll respond with your question first. And I think the core of my argument is not that we need more money. Right? Mm. I think the question that I'm asking is, are we allocating money correctly? And is the money getting to where it's needed? That's the first point of departure. Right? So with the provincial allocations of health, for us as the Rural Health Advocacy Project, we feel there's a significant gap. You know, in the statement on the Division of Revenue, there's a whole W1 section that deals with provincial actual share. Right? But the province, when they issue their budget, they don't tell us how they're going to spend their money or why they decided to allocate X amount of money here. For instance, in the Eastern Cape, 32 or 36% of the total budget, including conditional grants, is allocated to health. In the Northwest province, it's 26%. Right? But again, they add the conditional grant to the provincial equitable share and it increases the amount. But what we don't know is what they need. To come to the question from the Honourable Member on the critical post. Yes, we funded the critical post, but I had an old car when I was at university, Volkswagen Beetle, and I had to fix it every time. So eventually it cost me so much money to fix this car over time instead of a once-off engine overhaul. And the challenge that we're facing now, 3 years into fiscal consolidation / austerity measures / moratorium on posts, is that we have a system that's actually been debilitated. You know, we're not operating at full capacity in the health system. There's so many vacancies. Like, there are rules. I'm not a specialist in the PFMA or the rules around HR. But if a post isn't filled in 6 months, then it's taken off. That box no longer exists. So our vacancy rates are not clear indications of what our need is. So right now where we're sitting is that health has a challenge. And because district health, and this is why I'm here with the committee today, district health is a provincial competence, but it has a national impact. So when the province under-allocates money to district health services, we can't see it because in the figures that they give us, it's just an aggregate budget of district health services, not a distribution of what the money is spent on. Right? For instance, I was lucky enough to see a district health expenditure review, and they had 800% overruns on medicines. They had 300% overruns on an HR, and what we got back was that they were using goods and services in a different way, or that their funding reduced.
So the overrun was in relation to the funding that they received. And for us the problem is how does the province determine how much a district should get? Right? And if National Treasury can tell us that when they come together with the provincial equitable share, they look at this, this and this. But when the provinces allocate their money, they don't tell us nothing. I mean, Gauteng says, okay, we'll spend so much on health. Northwest says we'll spend so much, but we don't know what the money is going to be spent on and what is included and what isn't. Right? So the first instance we say we have to protect the people that are most vulnerable. For us as rural people, because they have no other option, they can't go to the there's no private practitioners in the villages because it doesn't make financial sense for them to be there. If they want to go to a clinic different from the one where they are located, it will cost them half their pension to get there. You know, and we're saying we should protect our most vulnerable people, and we do that by looking at how we allocate money to those people most in need. That was the first instance. In terms of Mr. McLaughlin's question, is like, how do we fix rural health? We're saying at the moment, we're going to diagnose the problem. We feel there are too many layers of how we allocate money within the system to health, and too little accountability about who's responsible for what. If we look at the life isidimeni issue, right, where we move patients on the basis of cost, right? Because these were very, very vulnerable people, as all of you are well aware now, that in the one facility it costs 400 rand a day to treat them, and someone in their wisdom figured out that if we deinstitutionalize, we can actually save 50% of what we're spending at the moment. And maybe that wasn't the only decider, but when you have 1,000 patients costing you 10,000 rand a month, it's 1 million rand a month. You cut that in half, it's 500,000, and because of the environment where we're in, where we don't want over expenditures, we say, okay, fine, let's do this, and we deal with the consequences later. And in health, we can't do that, because the impact of our cuts now has a lasting impact. And I think the third part of my argument, to come back to some of the comments more broadly, is that on a national level, we're investing heavily in achieving this health system that works for all, which is one of our NDP goals. But we're not countering that by an investment in the system on the provincial level to ensure that district health works, that provincial health is in a position to be able to manage its competing priorities. And that's why that's the main reason why we lifted the example of non-communicable diseases. I'm not an advocate for non-communicable diseases, but what I'm saying is if we're funding on what happened in the past, it won't allow us to see what's happening now. Right? One of the things that National Department of Health talks about is the primary healthcare engineers. And we invest heavily, it's one of the pilot projects of the NHI, in improving health facilities. So the 11 districts that are prioritized at the moment, and they receive extra funding through infrastructure and the NHI grant, to actually try and respond to this. But in reality, the provinces that resource their clinic is not funding enough money to have a full staff complement. And what I'm saying is that compromises the investment that we're making in NHI. So on a national level, we're allocating 300 rand. The province is meant to be allocating an equivalent of 300 rand, but there's no way for us to check whether they're contributing 300 or 100. I understand the power that provinces have to impact on development, and I agree that rural development includes health. If we follow the writings of the same, for instance, we say, if we look at the capability of the individual in a rural area, and our job as development partners, as government, is to improve the capability of that person to respond, then that's our job. So we can't look at rural health in isolation from rural development. I unfortunately work for the Rural Health Advocacy Project. At the moment, the way we fund health, we don't fund health as a part of rural development. We fund health separately. You know, so the questions that I'm asking today is that, yes, we need a radical transformation. Transformation that starts with us in terms of how we do business in government, right? Rural development and health are the two primary goals of the NDP, but we've got two totally different development trajectories, and there's no mechanism for us to be able to reach, and that's why we're asking the money. Are we funding in the right way? Are we asking the wrong questions, and so forth? And then with Mr. Fick, I think it all comes back to, it's really just about the distribution of resources and where we're holding people to account. Right? And I think, yes, health has a case to answer, but I think at the end of the day, this is really just an allocation decision. And where your purview with the division of revenue bill is to look at all those transfers to see whether they are reaching the ground and where are the risks.
And our view is at the moment we don't have a full estimation of what the risk of provincial financial failure is and whether those resources are being allocated in the correct way. And we'd like to just place the spotlight on health and saying that we need equitable funding for rural people because they make up 40% of our population, that the vast majority of them are youth, and they are struggling with a failing system, and if we don't do anything now, we're going to import those problems into our cozy little urban centers, or we're not going to achieve our goals as articulated in the NHR. Thank you.
Are there any follow-up questions?
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. You know, the response makes me more convinced that we should have the Department of Health here, because what I hear from the response is that it is not so much the lack of funding. It is so much the fact that we don't know how the failure of provinces to allocate properly. So we need to have them so that we can understand. But more than that, I just learned from the Minister of Finance that, you know, this impasse that we have of national department saying they can't assist because there is a certain competence that belongs to provinces can be bypassed by looking at section 44.1, I think, so 44.1 and 44.2, by departments introducing some legislation to actually allow them to assist the provinces, because, you know, over and above, we are one unitary state, and section chapter 3 insists on cooperative government. There's a section that says all spheres shall perform their duties in a manner that does not divide the Republic of South Africa. So we can't after 20 years come with excuses of it is because it's a province or a municipality. That doesn't hold water. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member Shopestole. Honourable Member Imam.
Thank you, Chair. Let me just start off with the issue of the sugar tax. I think the Minister has quite clearly said that, and it's just a matter of time whether we're going to really see that happen. And what he did say is that the revenue that we are going to collect from the sugar tax is not going to be swallowed by the fiscus itself, but what is going to be happening is also going to be used for prevention and trying to combat and encourage people not to take fizzy drinks and sugary products. So I think that the pressure that we can put from all angles to ensure that happens is important. But I want you to tell me, what role do you play as this organization in ensuring in the different areas, and specifically the ones that you come from, in terms of this budgeting process and the strategic plans that come from there? You understand? So I want to know what, on the ground when that happens, because remember it comes from the bottom upwards. So I want to know what role you play in ensuring that their budgets are in line with the needs of that community, given the fact, and what you've just told us, over 40 or 50% of the people come from the rural area. And if that is not happening, what do you envisage we should do in the future? Thank you.
Maybe before you respond, because your response now will be rounding up the discussion, am I right? All right. I would like to deviate from the normal method of work. Because we have advertised our meeting and we have said this is public hearings, I would also like to ask from others who have come if they've got any comment, because it's public hearing and we've invited everyone. Anyone who has a comment or maybe a question, introduce yourself so that you can be correctly captured.
Good afternoon, Chair. My name is Thabo Lesoro. I am from the Eastern Cape, and I'm independently representing myself in this hearing, but with the idea to develop to sort of the understanding of some of the comments and views that were shared here, and hopefully develop that further. Chair, I would just like to maybe just put forward that the last presentation kind of really spoke to me, because I'm coming from a rural province, I think, where issues of improving public health and the need for advocacy is kind of tied into the same kind of question. So for me, I basically wanted to say that some of the issues that were spoken about today tied on how the process of the division of revenue has an effect or relationship with province, and how maybe we need to think from a systems approach. How do we better understand that transfer as a governance issue? But I wanted to maybe stay clear from that for now, and look at maybe the potential in the advocacy and looking at that, and how do you sort of think what are the needs of those, what are the health needs of those communities? When the presentation also speaks about that, you know, the diabetes and these prevalent ailments and diseases that are in those communities. How do you look at that from also a medical perspective too? So I wanted to say thank you for that the committee could sit and also attend to people who wanted to present today. But I probably just wanted to maybe put that out as comment and just develop it a little bit further. Thank you.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to ask you, because it's now on the subject matter, it will maybe be easier for us to respond now than wait. And I think quite a few key points have been raised, and maybe what is also quite important is to link this discussion with some of the future work that this committee is intending to do. And that is that there will be a joint sitting by the Standing Committee on Appropriation and the Portfolio Committee on Health, which will take place 22, 23 and 24 March. And I think this session is actually quite a good session as an introduction to that session that will go into much more detail per province. And I don't know how your resources look, but it could be useful for you to attend. So I think that is quite key. And one of the issues is you've got the division of revenue and how it deals with the provincial equitable share and allocates per province. And very correctly pointed out, then the second decision is how the province then determines the breakdown between the various sectors. And what would be quite interesting in that hearing is maybe to look at how much percentage that province actually allocates towards health. And the question that was posed, is that sufficient? For example, if you look at the Western Cape, they allocate like very much more than most other provinces towards health. And of course, that will mean they allocate less to basic education. So that could be quite a key issue to explore. But also linked to that is also looking at potential efficiencies. And maybe rather than just focusing on what are provinces doing wrong, which I'm sure we can get a lot of examples, but what we've done in some of the work that we've been doing with provincial treasuries is to look at which provinces have looked at innovative ways of doing things differently. And what is sometimes shocking is, and I know Praveen Gordhan was then the Minister of COCTA, Back to Basics, but the same applies to provinces as well. For example, some of the wastage that's taking place, you know, could free up money if it's used much better. For example, how do you manage your medicines, for example? Do you take, and I mean it was on Carte Blanche as well, do you take the medicines that you get and you just plonk it in front? Or do you push the old medicine forward? Because what often happens, medicines expire, for example, and that is bad management of your resource. Another example that we've got is that, for example, is doing comparisons with other provinces in terms of bed utilization. And for example, Western Cape has done quite a bit of work to ensure that their bed space are optimally utilized. And KZN has actually gone and learned from them and applied some of those benefits. And it means cost savings. So it's not just about the money that's allocated, but how the money is spent and how efficiently it's spent. But I think another key issue that's also mentioned, health is not a provincial competence. It's not. Yes, it is, partly. But it's a concurrent function, and that is what we often lose. National departments are there to prescribe norms and standards. And some of the issues that you mentioned is, how does the disease burden change over time? Those are also things that where the communication between the national departments and the provinces are key, so that they actually ensure that their budgets are appropriately reconfigured. Honourable Sithole, I can give you the assurance we're not under austerity. Austerity means that you actually cut budgets. We're still growing budgets, so we're just using budgets better at this stage. But maybe what is also quite key is, and I'm sure it will come up during this three-day session as well, the initiatives that's currently in place between national and provinces as well. What we do is, provinces don't just do their budgets, National Treasury looks at their budgets and actually assist them to ensure that their budgets are funded. But we've also got specific sessions that just focus on health and just focus on education. But of course, then it's the provincial legislature process as well. So I definitely think that that three-day session could be quite useful to learn quite a few lessons. And then with regard to the questions on the NHI, I mean, the grant is there to learn lessons. And most probably it would be quite useful also to ask the National Department of Health to actually have a frank discussion on what they've learned so far. Again, they've done certain things that are pushing us in the right direction, and also there's been a few boo-boos, but that's what happens in a process when you're piloting. So hopefully the MPM could also assist with taking the discussion forward.
Well, thank you so much for your input. The only correction that I want to make in your input was calling Minister Praveen Gordhan unparliamentary. Okay, thank you so much. I think you are the last one then. But before Wendy, you know, I had this, also I had written this to say we must invite him to this meeting that will be focusing on health services, delivery of health services to ensure value for money and efficient planning and resource allocation. So you've read my mind, but thank you so much for bringing it up.
Again, thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, for the opportunity to engage with you on the issues of health resource allocation. I think I look forward to the meeting. But in closing, yes, the statistics are there. You know, if you look at the stats, say causes of death report that came out now, I think it's there plain for everybody to see, and that's where we get our information. In terms of how we work, I have I'm in charge of health systems and policy. So my job is to obviously look at all of these things from a national, provincial, and district level. We've got a program called the Rural Proofing Program, is where we work with district municipalities on defining their situations, understanding their needs, and to a point trying to understand whether the response is appropriate. And I think the reason why we're here is that because the message that we're getting from districts is that their hands are tied. You know, that they don't really have control over their budgets. There's very particularly now in the time when we're trying to manage our budgets more effectively, they feel hamstrung, and I think it's from that point of view that we felt that this year our focus to the division of revenue would be about provincial allocations and are we allocating enough and how we can change the process of resource allocation at the high level. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We will now move on to the other presentation. And appreciate if in your presentation you can focus on the key areas for our attention and further action. Equal education.
Good afternoon, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members and Stakeholders. Thank you so much for having us. So first and foremost, I'd just like to introduce myself. My name is Pilile Ntombela Mason. I'll be presenting on the equitable share formula. My presentation will probably slightly overlap with the previous one, but I promise not to wax too lyrical less or less in the afternoon. My colleague here, Demi Petherbridge, will be touching on a submission we made last year, just to find out on the National Biological Crisis. So, first and foremost, I'd just like to introduce our company, our organization. Equal Education is a membership-based democratic movement made up of teachers, parents, principals, community members. And the point is to achieve quality and equality in South African education. We do this by means of research and mass movements, often sometimes legal action, and we're based quite extensively around the country with 5 provinces, but our head office is in the Western Cape. Good. So just to begin with the equitable share formula. So rural South Africa is home to about 50% of the country's population, but makes up 58.3% of the country's poor. So poverty is an issue that affects South Africa as a whole, as we all are well aware, but this burden is far heavier on rural society, which is the reason why we strongly recommend that the equitable share formula be revised to start to consider the needs of rural areas and rural provinces when allocating funds. With particular reference, we're going to be looking at the education component and the poverty component. So, as you can see, there's a stat here, a quote here, on showing us that poverty in South Africa is actually stratified along rural urban lines, and it is quite stark in terms of that. So to begin, the concentration of poverty in rural areas, along with the historic underfunding of the former homelands, is something that we feel requires governmental intervention. A key instrument for redress will be the equitable share poverty component. We feel that this component is devastatingly low at 3% for something that is so ubiquitous in our society and that needs a lot of attention. And we also feel that it would help with the issues that are affecting especially rural South Africa. On the other hand, we also know that ordinary public schools in South Africa are organized by quintile systems, so ranging from 1 to 5, 5 being the most affluent, 1 being the poorest. Quintiles 1 to 3 don't pay school fees, which means all of their funding is completely state dependent. Whereas quintile 4 and 5, they get a bit of subsidy from parental and guardian fees. Now, the funding for non-capacitor, non-personnel expenses occurs in a sliding scale, with quintile 1 schools receiving the most funding because they'll be the poorest and most in need of state help, and quintile 4 and 5 receiving the least because they're very much capable of topping themselves up. Now, a disproportionately high number of quintile 1 to 3 or no-fee schools are located in rural provinces. And you can see here we have a stat that says 92.5% of learners...
Sorry, Chetri, don't you have that presentation for us as well? We don't have that, and we're a little bit lost, and you're giving us very valuable information.
No. Yeah, I'm sorry, we don't have any more hard copies. If we give it to you in a flash disk, would maybe it be able to be sent through?
Changes for progress, it's more or less what is here in the actual document that they handed out. So it's, I'm okay with it that we get a hard copy, electronic copy of the presentation, PowerPoint, and I can follow it here, unless somebody else has problems following it, but I can follow it here. Thank you.
Great, thank you. So what we've discovered is that 92.5% of learners in Limpopo, which is a rural province, attend no-fee schools or attended no-fee schools in 2016, while in the Western Cape it was only 41.6% of the learners attending these schools. This just goes to show the high number of learners attending quintile 1-3 schools in rural provinces, which renders the cost of education very, very high. And since government actually has to fund this as a per learner system, the funding based on these numbers means that there's more government support required in rural provinces than in urban provinces. Now, the legacy of apartheid means that these schools were often underfunded already, and left them in desperate need of water, sanitation, basic amenities, and a lot of them are made of inappropriate materials. An example of that is that 84% of the schools which continue to suffer without a water supply are located in the Eastern Cape and KZN, again, rural provinces. And now, we acknowledge that township schools in urban areas may require similar attention, may require similar aid, but the sheer number of these schools that require state support, actually, the majority of them are located in rural provinces rather than urban provinces. In Gauteng, 4% of the schools relied solely on rainwater harvesting. In KZN, it was 49%. These numbers start to show the great divide that happens across these lands of urban and rural. We also looked at what the previous presentation said, which was low population densities. Now, what this means for education is that there are more schools in rural provinces than there are in urban provinces. For example, in 2016, Eastern Cape had 15.4% of South Africa's registered learners, but 23.1% of the schools in South Africa. Gauteng had 16.6% of the national enrollment and 8.8% of South Africa's total public schools. So you're getting more schools, like a huge number of schools amongst a smaller number of learners in a rural province, and that's due to the fact that learners are too far away to go to a school that you can't expect them to go to a school that's far further than them because they don't have it. They need to go to a school that's in their immediate locality. So the DBE has suggested rationalization of small schools to help with economies of scale, to achieve economies of scale. What we say is that also comes at a cost, because the process requires capacity of the receiving schools to be expended. Classrooms, hostels have to be built. These new schools must be equipped with better infrastructure than the original school, a sufficient amount of teachers, learners require transport, and so forth. So regardless of whether or not we rationalize these small schools in rural provinces, there's still a high cost of education. And another thing is that another thing is that because often in smaller schools you have more teachers, so more teachers to learner ratios, we do have to pay for more teachers. So in either case, rationalized or not, there's a high cost to the province and the provincial education departments than there are in urban provinces. And so we want to actually get Treasury to start to consider that equitable share formula, to start to look at a cost-based formula that will consider how rural provinces and urban provinces actually cost, like how much they pay for schooling and education. Thank you.
Okay, good afternoon, Honourable Chair and committee members. As my colleague said, my name is Demichelle Petterbridge and I'm going to continue with our submission specifically on the area of scholar transport. Now, as I think the Honourable Committee is aware, there are thousands of learners that walk every day to very far, that cover very far distances to school every day and back. And for many, this is quite a difficult journey, which includes walking over mountainous areas, hills, crossing flooding rivers, being exposed to extreme weather conditions. Often walking in the fear of being subject to kidnappings and muggings, arriving at school tired, hungry, and unable to concentrate. And for many, learners go home without being able to finish homework and study, either for a lack of energy or because they have other domestic chores to finish. So the lack of scholar transport means that these learners are not able to actually access learning and basic education the way that other learners are. And this is a violation of their constitutionally protected right to basic education. The provision of scholar transport is therefore crucial to make sure that these learners arrive at school on time, safely, and are awarded the opportunity to at least achieve their academic goals. So year after year, the lack of scholar transport keeps affecting learners, particularly in rural areas. And in our research, we've seen how data indicating the number of learners actually in need of scholar transport is often inconsistent, outdated, differing between documents, differing between departments. But what remains clear is that the demand for scholar transport far exceeds the supply for it, the supply of it. So to give you an example, the Department of Education's recent annual report, 2015-2016, states that around 516,000 learners identified as requiring scholar transport, of which only around 386,000 are actually transported. In the Department of Basic Education School Readiness Report, which was published this year, they state that around 524,000 learners have been identified nationally as requiring transport, but provincial plans only cater for 405,000 learners in the financial year. Interesting enough, the Department of Basic Education also reports in the same report that Gauteng, Mpumalanga, and the Western Cape provide scholar transport to all their learners, whereas, for example, we see in KwaZulu-Natal only half the learners in need receive scholar transport. What this is saying is that there are tens of thousands of learners that are not being catered for, and these are usually, or a majority of these, are in particular provinces where they suffer really adversely as compared to areas with rural and urban areas. So they're severely affected. So while provincial departments are claiming that they have budgetary constraints, Equal Education is actually calling for a change or a change in the approach to funding, and we're asking for a conditional grant specifically for scholar transport. On 7 April 2015 and 11 March 2016, EE highlighted key issues that are actually affecting the way scholar transport is being planned for and budgeted. And these included, for example, an ineffective coordination between the Department of Transport and the Department of Education, inaccurate and inconsistent data indicating the number of learners in need of scholar transport, and continuous under-budgeting and underfunding for the provision of scholar transport by provinces, particularly those with rural areas. EE feels that a conditional grant would alleviate some of these problems. For example, a conditional grant would ensure that specific funding will be allocated for the provision of scholar transport and not be left to the discretion of provincial departments. Also, in the awarding of a conditional grant, we know that these are subjected to very strict levels of scrutiny and accountability, which we feel will ensure more effective and transparent monitoring of spending and spending. We also feel that through a conditional grant, the specific needs of each province will be catered for, assisting those provinces that service a greater demand for scholar transport. In terms of possible design features of a conditional grant, EE feels that the grant allocation formula should take into account physical terrain crossed by learners, for example, in a province, the number of learners qualifying for scholar transport in a province, and the kind of distances that these learners have to travel. The grant allocation formula could also be based on a detailed cost analysis of provincial costs and expenditure, taking into specific consideration, for example, the different modes of transport in a province, route accessibility, and the quality and availability of road infrastructure. The grant should also be able to fund different interventions appropriate to each province. And lastly, the grant should be linked to outcomes, I mean, to outputs and performance indicators to ensure effective monitoring and accountability.
So in May 2016, this committee recommended to Treasury that in partnership with, amongst others, the Department of Education and Civil Society, it explore options that allow for the ring fencing of funding allocated to scholar transport to be used solely and exclusively for that purpose. Treasury was meant to respond within 60 days. Since June 2016, EE has attempted to engage Treasury on this recommendation, unfortunately with little success. As it stands, the 2017 Division of Revenue Bill does not indicate that funds have been specifically set aside exclusively for the use of scholar transport. In addition, Treasury has not made any clear commitment to even consider the allocation of a conditional grant for this particular area. EE feels that without substantive changes to the way funding happens around scholar transport, learners are going to continue walking these journeys, and the issue of scholar transport is going to remain a crisis. In terms of our recommendations, recommends that Treasury make a solid commitment to revising the equitable share formula to take into account costs of education provisioning in rural areas when calculating the education component and increasing the poverty component in the formula, that the time frame for the equitable share review be made public, and that the review must include a period of public consultation on proposed models for a new equitable share formula. In terms of scholar transport, EE recommends that this Honourable Committee reiterate its previous recommendation that a conditional grant be awarded and properly considered for scholar transport. The committee also called Treasury to account before the committee on all steps taken toward the design and implementation of a conditional grant, including steps to engage all relevant stakeholders. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your submission. Honourable members, do you have clarity questions?
Yes,
and we can further engage on the presentation. I think everybody here now know that they can also make their input. Honourable member Imam, Honourable member Dr. Peek, Honourable member Shopis.
Thank you, Chair. I know when we previously, thank you for your presentation, incidentally. When we previously met, I know there was a concern expressed that despite all your attempts to talk to basic education and to Treasury, it seems to be ignored. I'd like you to tell us whether there's any progress in that matter, whether they're now speaking to you in terms of the recommendations that you make from time and your findings. I also want you to comment on the quintile system and its disadvantages to learners that are living in the urban areas. And I think we did discuss this at some time, where you find that there are those that are in the schools in the urban areas, but that are totally disadvantaged, and that's why the system of just allocating funds to those 1 to 3 in rural areas, while it's perfect and it's good, but it also disadvantages those in the urban areas that may be also, you know, coming from a very poor background. So I just want to know what you have actually. You know, your recommendations, like you made before, it's really reasonable. It's fair. I mean, given the circumstances. And again, if you talk about the SONA, if you talk about it all, you talk about addressing the inequality and bridging that gap. This is where it starts from the ground in terms of education. But I don't know what your mandate is. In terms of, because I have a very serious challenge with the quality of education in the rural schools. We as this committee have made oversight visits, and I must tell you, and I'm going to reiterate, there were times when I saw no educators, I saw child minders. There is a principle that every school is going to be an ideal school, with all the benefits, sporting facilities, laboratories and everything.
we still don't see that. When we've been there, I don't know your role in terms of that and whether you're making like recommendation in terms of your finding in terms of it. And yes, there's a very important question here. What is happening to the other tens of thousands of learners if transport is not being provided? So I think it's a very, very important point, and maybe, again, Chair, I think like my colleague Triple S has said previously, Honorable Triple S, I think what is very important, when we have this, maybe then we need to have basic education to come here as well. And maybe we need to get the Department of Transport to come here so they can sort out their problems and decide who's in control of the transport. Maybe we should do that. I'll stop there for now.
For record purposes, Triple S. I know about Triple P in government. Okay, that was on a lighter note. Over to you, Honorable Dr. Fink.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. There seems to be some sort of resistance by role players and stakeholders to talk with yourselves. The last time you accused basic education, and this time you're accusing our good friends opposite me. I think what we need to do, it's just a suggestion, is maybe we must, I'm not saying that you're not talking nice to them, because at the end of the day, we need to work together. It's a serious problem, so we need to, Chair, we need to get the parties together. The last time, as Honorable Sheikh Imam said, that basic education didn't have a problem and is now asked a follow-up question whether they are engaging with equal education. I'm convinced that Treasury will talk. I'm surprised to hear that there is a problem, but nevertheless. So it's something that one needs to do and to sort out, because listening to the figures here, that 50% and 40%, whichever figure you use, of people are in the rural areas and they need to be helped. It's a serious challenge, and again, I'm going to say that I wouldn't want to be the person that's trying to resolve that with the large geographical area that these, in this case, the learners residing, and everybody in South Africa, every child needs and has the right to an education. So I would like to see and maybe from equal education as well, a concrete proposal, because I understand that money is needed and money must be given, but thinking about it, you know, if you have a child living, okay, you know, if you cover an area of about 400 square kilometers, I'm using that as an example, and I don't have the numbers, but you have, for example, 100 children, I'm just using an example, you know, it has to be a little difficult, so, you know, we need somebody to come for a practical example that's going to work. You know, so that's something that I would like to see somewhere. And if equal education and not the persons or the party that will get those figures or that research, somebody needs to do it. Because of the problems that we have that needs to be resolved. Then this rationalization that we talk about, we understand to achieve economies of scale, Honorable Chair, but in some instances it's not practical. So perhaps I could ask the question here, would you support it? And perhaps what we also need in South Africa, and maybe you can comment on this, is we understand in there's a ratio which you can use and it makes sense in urban areas, but in your rural areas where I can't believe that you need a teacher for grade 1 maths and then another teacher for grade 2 maths, and then another teacher for grade 3. So perhaps maybe a solution could be a multi-skilled teacher, like we used to have in the old days, and it worked. I think I'm educated enough. So maybe we should look at something like that. Maybe that's where our problem is. Maybe the teachers these days are doing much less than they can do. I'm not saying... Maybe then again, and sorry for raising this point, maybe OBE is not the way to go, you know, I don't know. Maybe the teachers those days were, yeah, maybe they were just better teachers, so I'm just saying maybe that's where the problem is. Then, the issue of the scholar transport, yeah, okay, I've spoken about this. The question I wrote here is this practical? Yeah. It's a difficult one. It's just a question that I don't have the answer to, and I'm
and I'm not going to make a suggestion, but one really needs to look at how to do it. It has to be done, but how? And that's what I would like to see. And then linked to that is the, I also don't see a cost unless there has been a cost that has been given previously, and it was a total cost. I understand that a grant has been requested, a conditional grant, yeah, and also to ring fence the grant, but do we have a cost? Has anybody calculated what it will cost for this project, for this program, a total cost? And Chair, I'm nearly done. No, I'm done. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honourable Member Shukes Foley.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm very grateful for this input because it draws us to one conclusion. Are we getting value for money in education? That is what we must focus on as this committee for this year at least. And I have a question for Treasury. Why do you ignore our recommendation? And lastly, Chair, I think we must call the Department of Education together with these people because, you know, the biggest chunk of our budget goes to education, and we can't make mistakes on that one. If we, as a committee, we can just focus on health and education and parastatals just for this year, I think we'll save South Africa a lot of resources. And Darren, you mustn't talk to the chair when I am talking because she will miss the important point that I was making. Chair, I was saying we focus on health, education, and the parastatals so that we can save a lot of money. Treasurer must still answer. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me start with the question that was posed to Treasury. Why do we ignore a recommendation by the committee? In our response to the question, and that is the issue that's really quite problematic for us, the role division between the National Department of Transport and the National Department of Basic Education is not known. If you look at some of the documentation that's written, it still allows for whatever agreements are agreed to between the two national departments, and that is where the problem comes in. A conditional grant on scholar transport will not or should not be administered by the National Treasury. It should be administered and created for the National Sector Department responsible for that function. And that is where the problem lies. We do not know who's responsible for that. And a recommendation was made, and National Treasury, together with Basic Education, together with Transport, should be called into the committee to take this matter forward, because National Treasury hasn't got the levers to fix that policy gap, for lack of a better word, and that is where the problem lies. In our responses to the committee, we did indicate that it's critical for us to have clarity on that functional division, because what happens when a conditional grant is established, it's not National Treasury that establishes a conditional grant. Yes, we have a vehicle that goes through the Division of Revenue Bill, which later becomes an act. What we do when a national department wants to create a conditional grant, we give them what we call a template, so that they fill in all the relevant questions so that we can see and assist them to be ready to implement the grant. It's the national department that's responsible for creating the grant, for administering the grant, for overseeing the grant. Of course, National Treasury comes in and see whether the grant is spent. So we've got broader oversight. And that is where really the clarity is needed for us. National Treasury will just as much agree with Equal Education that scholar transport is critical in the system. And again, how you balance that with hostels as well, and how do you balance the two is critical in the process. So, but there's another recommendation that Equal Education has made, and I'm going to shock Equal Education, but the issues that you've raised is already on our radar screen, and we agree with those are issues that must be taken up as part of the Provincial Equitable Share Review. The Provincial Equitable Share Review will be undertaken in three phases. We've already completed the first phase, where it was basically a data scoping exercise to see what type of data is out there that we could potentially use, because we can only use data that's credible, that's verifiable, and endorsed either by SAS-SA or the National Sector Department. And where the really, really good news comes is that in our scoping exercise, we determined that the Department of Basic Education has already acknowledged that there's a big gap in the way they currently collect data on schools, i.e. 10 days after the school is open, they count the children. And they realize that they need a much more comprehensive system. And so that will create an opportunity to look at all the data that you've mentioned. Is it possible to incorporate in the data in the formula, and if so, how? But the issue about, you know, the cost differentiations between urban and rural, and the quintile issues, and how it actually distorts both allocations for urban provinces, but also more for rural provinces on DT, because where the distortion takes place on the urban side is that quintiles 4 and 5 are not counted, although they cater and provide schooling for poor children and scholars as well. And with regard to quintiles 1, 2 and 3, that there is a difference between you, whether you're a full no-fee school or you get partial subsidies, and that can bring in distortion. But those issues we're definitely going to take up in the review, and our intention is to actually see how much we can actually implement from the 2018 MTF, and our intention is also to indicate what we've done as part of the 2017 medium-term policy statement as part of the documentation that we present there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the presentation from WE. I want to check, they are indicating the challenges on the inconsistency on the data for the scholars requiring the transport. Who is responsible to do that data? Because we can't just maybe point to the treasurer to say the monies are not sufficient, or the or whoever, without knowing who is responsible for giving inconsistent data that is not assisting during the budget. And have you ever engaged about that inconsistency with the relevant, either DPE or Department of Transport, because it's like shared service, that's what they must do. Secondly, you talk about the issue of rationalization, that the DPA has come up as a recommendation to try and address the challenge of these vast areas, in rural areas and the schools thereof. But what do you think must be done? Are you supporting the rationalization? I know that you indicated on your report that maybe it will assist the provinces, you know, to try and cap this a challenge. But are you supporting the rationalization? If we are not supporting it, what is the alternative proposal that you think it will assist this challenge that is being faced in the deep rural areas of being vast pool in a different area? Besides saying that the treasurer must come up with a clear calculation on the cost of rationalization, because you have indicated that it will cost maybe a lot also, which is not going to
this rationalization, which will also maybe affect the transporting of the kids to the school because of the budget that has been spent on the rationalization. I think I agree with you to say that we need to understand what will be the cost of that particular rationalization. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think I've got two. One is a question, one is a comment. And I think my concern is that from what I've heard from Equal Education, you were expecting a response, and despite numerous requests, you've never. I think that's where the problem is, that Treasury has totally, you know, ignored you and have not. And I think that is a problem, because even though there's a process in place, but there's nothing wrong in communicating with each other, because it's people like Equal Education on the ground that have an idea of exactly what is happening there, and that is why their input is very, very important to us. Do you ever have any statistics at all on the physically challenged that use the scholar transport and that may have been affected? If you don't, can we at some stage, try and get some figures on physically challenged learners that need scholar transport or that are using this, so that if these 100,000+ are not getting that scholar transport, can you imagine how much more serious the challenge is if they physically challenge themselves or not? So if you can just try it at some stage, perhaps again. But I think I want to suggest to Chair that when we're calling basic education and transport, maybe we should also call equal education there as well. I think it will help us. I'll stop there, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think that... Honourable Member Swabaza.
Yeah, Chairperson, no, I don't have a question. I do have a homework for equal education.
Fortunately, they used to use concept.
Yeah. of course, jointly with basic education in particular. Look, we have no free schools, school feeding. Some instances, many instances, scholar transport. But we still have dropouts. So the question is, if you could please have a look at the causes of dropouts along the way up to end of the school year, the school period, schooling period, up to grade 12. It could be transport, because there are certain vulnerabilities that are linked to inavailability of scholar transport. You have mentioned that. What's the effect of drugs, of bullying, of weapons in the schools? You could look at the percentage of girls and the percentage of boys who, between the two, are most affected by dropping out of school and why. And what could be done? There might be other areas that you might find important to add to that kind of, to some of these issues. I'm not saying this is an exhaustive list. And what could be done to mop up this problem of dropouts? Because we would like to have 100% of school-going kids going through the education system. But we do know that there are such challenges. So if you could, that's a kind of homework, Chairperson, I was talking about. Because it's a serious worry as well. And it needs to be resolved. So that at some point, Chairperson, we must stop saying 15-year-olds are part of the unemployed, because that itself is a problem.
So true. That's one area where we find a leakage of the very limited resources. Because then there will be money, you know, injected, but with no outcome. Or impact. we lose some of the students who are supposed to take us to this educated nation. But then, because there's a high rate of percentage of dropout, it will take us years to move from a developing country to a developed country because of that leakage, which goes with money, which has got cost implications. All right, I think it was just a comment. I don't know if, is it another follow-up?
A comment.
Okay, you are allowed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I was absent for most of the response section, so I hope I'm not just saying what's been said already. If I am, please forgive me. Just a feeling I have is that basic education, we spend the biggest chunk of our budget is spent on basic education, and we produce the least result with that amount of money. Ma'am, as you know from what I've said in the past, I have a problem with water and sanitation in schools, because even the schools that do have water, it's total wastage. The toilet facilities are horrendous. It's an absolute mess, and nobody wants to take responsibility for it. The school says it's not our problem, we don't have the facilities, it's the municipality must look after it. The municipality says, no, it's not us, it's basic education. And basic education says, no, it's water and sanitation. And I think it's a similar sort of thing to the problem with the transport. My personal feeling is that basic education, if you're going to supply or provide a school, you must provide everything that goes with it. Teaching, the books, all the facilities, feeding the children, transport, water and sanitation, top to bottom, lock, stock and barrel must be in one department. You cannot have it scattered all over the place, because then you're just going to get it shunted around from bullet to post and nobody's ever going to take responsibility. So it really has to be placed in one point, and that point must be the accessible point and the accountable point. Thank you, ma'am.
The underlying message for us to achieve equal and quality education, we also need an environment that is conducive to learning, that is water and sanitation. For now, in the rural areas, it's a sad story. All right. No, thank you very much. I don't know if National Treasury would want to make their last comment or closing statement after, you know, listening to all the submissions.
Thank you for this opportunity. Stephen, we'll just give some feedback also on the SOGA presentation, because unlike the others, we didn't respond after that took place. But maybe just what is quite key as well is that, and we have been speaking to the researchers, there's an error in Schedule 3 of the Division of Revenue Bill that needs to be fixed. It cannot be fixed by National Treasury because it's part of the bill that will become part of the Act. And we've been in liaison also with our legislative team on how to fix it. You know, with computers, they're very clever, but sometimes the implementers are not always that clever. And something very funny happened, that the zero disappeared in all the municipal codes. So if a municipal code, for example, is EC101, in terms of that computer program, it gobbled up the zero, so then it became EC11. So the Schedule 3 needs to be fixed, and it is Parliament that will need to make that decision. That's the one thing. And then we would also like to give feedback on the reasons why the costing model of the FFC and SOGA has not been incorporated in the local government equitable share formula.
Thanks, Chair. We just feel that the costing model that SALGA and the FFC worked on came up in, it was discussed extensively on Friday in the FFC submission and again today. And I think there's it's a very technical costing model that they've produced. And I think there's a risk that maybe the impression was left with the committee that there's some kind of answer out there in this model, that there's we just want to say from our side that it's not a panacea, that costing model. It's very complex and it's very sensitive to the kind of assumptions that are made in the model. So I think on Friday we made the point that some of those assumptions about the types of services that you provide in rural areas actually mean that when we asked on a slightly earlier version of the model, so we didn't see the final model, but on an earlier version, we asked the consultants, if you used this to run allocations to individual municipalities, what would the impact be? And it had a few strange impacts, but in the general pattern was that it reversed all of the gains to rural municipalities that the new equitable share formula that we introduced from 2013 had made. So it led to significant reductions in rural areas, which I think is the opposite sometimes of the direction that the committee is wanting to go. It also highlighted the very high costs of administration in some municipalities, and there's some serious methodological weaknesses in the study on the administration costs, but the study at the end of the day came out with a result that the model would spend as much on administration of services to the poor as it would on the actual delivery of services to the poor. And I think to their credit, both the FFC and SALGA said that the conclusion that they drew from that is that municipalities have, something needs to be done about the way that municipalities do administration, that they weren't recommending that we now pay them to run these huge administration-heavy departments, that clearly that reflects a problem in the structure of municipalities, and that the solution, that we should have a system in which most of our money in the budget is spent on services to people, not administration. So I just, there are other things in the model, but I think those are, I would just caution the committee in thinking that the model is some kind of panacea, and then also just to remind the committee that the SALGA again raised the question around the 9% today, and just to remind you, on Friday we did present that if you take account of the own revenue to municipalities, in fact, municipalities account for 25% of the overall revenue raised by the three spheres of government, which is a much fairer sounding division of revenue. And of course, smaller rural municipalities do get twice as much per household as metro municipalities in the division of revenue. Thanks, Chair.
Okay,
Dr.
Were you saying something to me? I tried to read the sign language.
No, I was just, it's just that zero, I knew about the zero that was missing, so I was showing you, that's what I was showing you.
Oh, the zero.
Yeah.
108. See, this one also means grand. It's okay.
Uh-huh.
Good. Okay, no, that's fine. Okay, thank you so much. We have now come to the end of our engagement. And indeed, it was a robust engagement and very participative by all the members, and also we extended the participation to individuals who came from the broader community to come in, because of interest in these matters. I'd like to thank all of you for your full participation on these public hearings on the Division of Revenue Bill 2017. Much appreciation to the South African Local Government Association, Equal Education, and the Rural Health Advocacy Project, the National Treasury Team, and also remember the individual input, because it's allowed in public hearings. Individuals can come there on their own and make an input. Okay. It is clear that members wish to see the ESCOM debt issue resolved, and especially concerned with municipal revenue management and debt. There were also concerns raised on our health sector coordination and resource allocation, and including resource allocation and quality equal and quality in education sector with emphasis on rural areas. Have I quoted you correctly? Yes. Okay. Scholar transport is clearly an issue which needs to be resolved, and we will take this forward as a committee. And I think what would be also important is that National Treasury maybe coordinate the two departments and you sit with them so that they can, you know, you can engage and arrive at a conclusion on who exactly should, so that when National Treasury allocates money, National Treasury should know where to allocate that money for transport, for solid transport. Well, indeed, we are planning a meeting next week with health sector. You are also invited to that meeting. That will be focusing on effective coordination and value for money strategies in delivering health services. In closing, we appreciate that our public hearings are appreciated by stakeholders and our citizens find value in them. And please don't get tired of coming to engage us and tell us about your thinking in these areas of focus. All right. Thanks again to all our stakeholders. Thank you so much. I wish I could say the meeting stands adjourned, but before that, I just have an announcement to the members. I have received correspondence. I think with you we are fine. We're done. Honourable members, I have received correspondence whereby the Korean Embassy is inviting the committee to come and engage with us on those budgetary issues. And the date is on the 17th, the coming Friday. So if you are available, we will appreciate that you attend so that you can engage with these as they learn from us and ask them.